Joe Rogan Podcast. Check it out.
The Joe Rogan Experience.
Train by day, Joe Rogan Podcast by night, all day.
How long do you have to stop smoking weed before you'll test positive?
Usually about 5 days.
Five days before a fight?
If you're smoking straight flower. But if you're smoking like oil, dabs, anything like that, then you need a little bit more time.
You got down to a science?
I figured it out when I tested positive one fight because I was smoking oil and I stopped 5 days out.
Oh, smoking oil. Those wacky kids and their dabs and oil. You guys go too far.
There's way too many ways now, I feel like.
You go to dark places. You do dabs, you go to dark places.
With dabs, I'm like, that's the like next level extreme.
Yeah, I'm not interested in that. You just get too far gone. Like, you don't even know how to move your hands right.
There's this stuff that I'm a medical patient in Florida, and there's stuff you can get from the dispensary. It's like literal nose drops. And that shit like makes you like literally I feel like I can't form sentences.
Is this a spray?
Yeah, it's just like a nasal spray.
There's so many wacky people in Austin spraying ketamine up their nose. It is a real issue. We had a girl go into a K-hole at our comedy club the other night. Oh yeah, and her boyfriend's like, she just did a lot of ketamine. And we're like, Jesus fucking Christ. Do that at home, you nuts. They're doing ketamine and going to see comedy.
Yeah. From the moment I got here, it's been offered to me frequently.
What is going on? How's ketamine? Ketamine's a fucking tranquilizer, right?
Yeah.
It's a powerful psychedelic too, right?
It's also available in clinics for people to do PTSD work and stuff.
I feel like there's a lot of people that are doing it like every day, though. Have you done it?
No, I've never messed with anything like that.
I took a little of Duncan's. Duncan had one. I think he made it in his bathtub.
What did it feel like? Do you remember?
Weird. But it was very little. Just take one pump. So I took like one pump. And I was like, this is odd. But I know the source and I know where he's getting it. And it's all medical grade and legit. But it's like, what is that?
Yeah, I don't know. I like a lot of natural things better.
THC nasal mist. Well, I guess marijuana is the ultimate natural thing. I was just saying that I hurt my back a little bit. It tweaked a muscle, and it was locked up. And I put on this CBD MD Recover Cream. That stuff is insanely good. It's incredible how much better I felt.
No, that's crazy.
Amazing that CBD has that kind of power.
Yeah, I've never used a topical cream like that, but I've used like pills and things like that with CBD, and I feel like it definitely does make a difference. Like there's a huge difference.
Huge difference. My friend Dave Foley had real bad arthritis in his hands, and he started taking CBD, and all of a sudden his hands started working fine. Like it just took a while. Your body is filled with inflammation. And CBD is just an awesome way to get rid of inflammation.
Yeah, especially as a fighter.
Oh, yeah.
It's like everything's inflamed constantly.
Who needs CBD more than fighters, right? And who needs marijuana more than fighters? Just to fucking chill the fuck out. Like the stress that you go through on a regular basis is so bonkers. If you really think about it, you're around, you know, all these other human beings that are going about their day, driving their cars, going to work. You're preparing to throw bones at girls. You're preparing to strangle people. You put people to sleep for a living. You know, that is a wild thing to do, sister.
Oh, yeah. It's like pre-fight when I'm sitting there and I'm feeling all my nerves. My boyfriend, he's told me, he's like, you need to be thankful for this because he's like, most people don't get to experience shit like this in their life. Most people don't get to like experience these kinds of feelings, like these extreme feelings because they just have their regular jobs. Yeah. It's like what I'm doing is something crazy.
It's so crazy. It's so crazy. And when you do it in a place like was it in London with Molly McCann? Was that London?
It was actually Liverpool.
Liverpool.
Oh, yeah.
That was crazy. That was crazy. When you got her back and put her to sleep, I was like, oh, shit.
Oh, yeah. That was pretty much – it was my first fight out of the tough house, you know? So my UFC debut was technically against Emily Whitmire, but it was still – we were in the tough house. Like, we didn't have our actual fight kits, things like that.
Right.
So Molly McCann, I feel like, was really the first fight where I was like, this is a real UFC fight for me. And my flight was delayed. Everything, she missed weight. I feel like everything went wrong that week. I got booed walking out. So it's like – I don't know, just to get that success after that, I feel like was such a great thing for me.
How did they treat you when you got out?
After I got out, honestly, everybody was great. Like, even Molly invited me to her after party. My brother flew out there, so I ended up going out with him.
Oh, that's cool.
And we were just walking around Liverpool, and everybody coming up to me trying to get pictures. Like, the Liverpool fans were 100% supportive. It was great.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah.
Of course they're going to boo you.
Yeah.
Just a girl.
Oh, yeah, 100%. I expected every minute of it.
Plus, like, what a personality she has. Like, she's awesome.
Okay, I absolutely love her. Probably out of all the girls I fought in the UFC, Molly's definitely probably the top.
She's a character. Her and Patty together are fucking amazing. It's hilarious. It should be a reality show.
She's absolutely, like, genuine sweetheart of a person and, like you said, an absolute character as well.
And she could fight.
Yeah,
she can fight 100%. Her ass off. Her stand-up is nasty. It's really, she's so tough. She's so tough.
Yeah, all girls, I feel like, from that area, they got that extra mm-hmm. little toughness to them. And she definitely is superior in that.
Yeah, for her, it just feels like grappling came like a little later for her. Mm. And that can be a problem with someone of your caliber. You know, the thing about like grappling is, God, it takes so long to catch up. And while you're catching up, that person's still getting better. If they're training every day and it's like, when someone is at a super high grappling level, and if you're just getting into grappling now, like you're just surviving, and it's a long time until you're doing anything other than surviving, unless you're some athletic freak, unless you're some just unbelievable specimen of a human that just learns quicker than everybody else. Most of the time, it's like really hard to catch up when you're a pure striker.
Okay, there's just so much to learn in jiu-jitsu. Mm-hmm. Even like I got my black belt, I think, 2 or 3 years ago now, and I feel like I still don't know anything.
Yeah,
I feel like it's just like there's so much to learn, so many different styles, different things. Like even like leg locks, I don't know deep into that game. I know good defensively, but offensively, I feel like that's a completely different world.
Mm-hmm. The leg lock game is crazy because that just took over. It was so amazing to watch something that you used to get booed for. Like if they went to tournaments, especially in Brazil, people would boo you. They did not like when you were doing stuff like that. I guess because it really messes people up in training. Like they had to know it was really effective, but too many people had to ruin knees, and mm-hmm. they just decided like, hey, this is a bad idea. And it might be a bad idea in the gi. You know, in the gi, it's like, whoa, man, you can't get out of that very well. At least in no gi, there's like a little bit more maneuverability. When someone's like grabbing your legs and they got your pants and they're holding on to the cuff in here, it's like, ooh, that's tight for a leg lock.
Oh, yeah.
That's scary.
I'm almost more nervous competing no gi now than versus fighting MMA just because no gi girls are so well versed in leg locks and that shit's dangerous. It's like that can put me out for 6 months, a year plus, where it's like the worst thing I've ever had happen in a fight is I got 11 stitches in my nose. It's like besides that, well, and even that, I grappled a month later.
Who was that woman, that heavily tattooed woman? And you got her back too. She had a crazy nickname, like the Demon Slayer.
Maria Agpova.
Yes. What was her? Yeah. She has a wild nickname, right? Isn't it something like that?
Yeah, it's something like that. Yeah.
When you were fighting her, she hit you with a bunch of like really hard elbows while you were trying to take her down. And that was just amazed that you just stuck with the path. You're like, I got you. You're not getting away with this. I'm going to hang on to you, and I'm going to drag you to the ground. I'm going to get you. And when you finally did, I was like, damn, that was systematic. But you endured, like, some hard shots.
Honestly, I don't think, like, I don't know. I didn't really have any much damage off of those shots.
Wow.
So I didn't really feel a lot of those, and they weren't really, like, the only reason that I even thought about them is because the ref was like, you need to do something. I'm going to stop this. And I was like, oh, shit, I got to change something up. Mm. Like, but I was initially going for a knee bar and when she was just hitting me with elbows. And then I gave up on that because of the ref.
Isn't it interesting how subjective refereeing can be? And that there's some referees that are really good at letting people just fight out of stuff. And then there's some referees that, like, just getting hit even with a few hammer fists that aren't going to stop you if you don't defend them. Some refs will just stop it right there. It's just completely subjective. Like, for that ref to tell you that, like, you can't endure these shots it's you don't like you have the time. Like, actually, they're not that hard. Mm-hmm. It sounds bad, but it doesn't really hurt. I'm okay. Like, you can't say that in the middle of a fight. So there's this weird, like, communication issue. Like, he sees you getting hit by, I saw you getting hit by those shots. I was like, Jesus Christ. Like, can you see if you can find that? See if you can find that. Because in that exchange, when you're trying to take her down, I'm like, Jesus. Those are some hard elbows. Travis Brown was the master of that.
Oh, yeah. I feel like no one had more power than him when he was delivering those elbows.
And I think he kind of invented it, or at least he popularized it. We call it the Travis Brown, because he would drive down those elbows when you were trying to take him down. That was a horrible place to be.
I don't think I've seen people drop like I have with Travis Brown.
Well, he obviously drilled it. You know, I mean, it wasn't an improvised thing. At least I don't think it was. It just seemed so well-timed. And the force that he could generate, because he's so big and long. When you're a long person, like a John Jones type person, the amount of extra force that you have and all that length and torque. Yeah, so somewhere in the clinch, so we're going to get a view of your whole fight here.
Yeah, it's not on YouTube.
What is it like watching yourself fight? Is it weird?
I guess I don't know. I do it a lot. I use myself as motivation of how I should perform. A lot of times I watch my past wins just to really, I guess, relive that kind of feeling. So then it gives you something to chase the next fight.
Oh, that's brilliant. That's a great way to do it, especially since you've got these, you know, well-documented, awesome videos from the UFC of your wins. I mean, it's one of the coolest things ever to be a fan right now. That you could just watch fights at any time you want. Anytime. Right. Anytime. Instantly. You're watching fights.
I'm a huge fan of the sport just in general. So just being able to do that, like look up any type of – any fight, yeah. Anything you want. I'm like, it's crazy.
I love it. It's like the best time ever for high-level kickboxing. It's the best time for amateur wrestling. It's the best time for submission grappling. Like, there's never been more people that have been more interested in submission grappling now.
I think we got past the elbows here. This is where the chokes happen.
Yeah. This is – It must.
First round.
Yeah, first round.
Okay. Oh, is that round two? We can still watch that, though. I still want to watch that choke.
I skipped ahead. I'll go back.
Okay. Yeah, these are the, so is right here he's telling you have to do something?
No, it was I had her butt on the floor by this point because I actually knew she had an injured knee going into this fight.
Oh, how'd you know that?
She talked about it in interviews and I actually knew a couple people she trained with who told me.
Oh, a bunch of rats.
Yeah.
Dirty rats. Dirty rats. Do you feel bad taking that information?
And it is what it is. I definitely utilized it.
Yeah, you have to.
I try it.
You'd be crazy not to.
I probably wouldn't have committed to the knee bar so hard if I didn't know that knee injury was there.
Right.
So it's like... I started going for the knee bar, and she just kept on hitting me with elbows. And then once we were on the floor, I think he thought I was injured because I was committing to the knee bar, so I was trying to put hips down. So that's when he told me I needed to move.
It just started going in slow motion.
Why is it going in slow motion?
I don't know what's happening.
Is someone breaking down some specific...
No, it's on ESPN's web site. It's just freaking out.
It's the Russians. The Russians don't like Americans winning. They don't like it.
Skip ahead.
Okay. So at one point, you were getting drilled with elbows. I don't know if we're going to find it without watching the whole fight. But it was just an awesome performance overall. That and the Molly McCann one. You've had a bunch of them. And I think I was equally impressed with the Rose Namajunas grappling match. That was so slick. Like, the way you took her back and the controlling the position, like, you never lost an inch. Like, you just kept progressing until you got the choke. It was awesome.
Yeah, I feel like my choking game is definitely – it's different than anybody else's, and it's something that – it's a feel that I've been working on for years, and I feel like I still haven't even perfected it. But I feel like I'm getting closer and closer to making it perfect. And I think the Rose – grappling match was probably one of the opportunities where I feel like I really got it just that little bit more close to perfect where I wasn't even on her throat at first. She had her chin tucked and My hand was in poor position, and I feel like I was just able to walk it closer and closer until I was able to make that hole tighter, and she had to give up her throat at that point.
Well, what I was super impressed with was your use of the shoulder, how you're using your right arm to control the shoulder, because you don't quite have it, but you've got a nice grip on the cup of the shoulder, and you're using that leverage, like that improvised. Then when you switched to the gable grip, I was like, oh, shit. The gable grip was it. But when you were using her shoulder, I was like, that's brilliant.
Oh, yeah. Dean always tells me, he's like, if her chin tucks, you should be able to break it, you know? Mm. It's like the goal is to break the jaw. So just creating that pressure with just closing the circle, you know, mm-hmm. trying to make that circle smaller. So I'm just inching my hand deeper, my head deeper until I can really just make it so it's too small.
And I love what you said that you have like a feel for it, because I think people would think of it like, oh, it's just like, you know the movement, you do it, right? But it's just like everything else. It's like playing guitar. It's like any other thing that you learn how to do that's difficult. There's like levels and levels and levels and levels and levels. And when you watch like really high level black belts going at it, going back and forth and trying to keep up with each other, it's like, whoa. Like you're watching like the craziest kind of game ever.
All right. I'm like, I've taught my choke to multiple people, and I feel like people just don't get it still, because it's like it's something I've worked on for years.
So what's specific about your choke?
It's just the way that I have my pressure. I feel like I can generally finish it with one hand. I never really look for the hook, so I'm usually just searching for it opportunistically, so I get it whenever it's almost too late to defend it. Mm. And even just like the pressure of my choke, though, I think it's something that anybody could learn, but it's just a lot of patience, because it's something that's so basic and so simple. But like I said, I've drilled it 1,000 times, and I don't think I have it right yet. So I think it's just you really have to put the time and effort into one specific motion, which a lot of people don't have time for.
So you just over and over again drilled it, or you just over and over again used it in training? What sparked this strangulation reign that you've been on? Like, how did that start?
It's definitely both. I feel like a lot of my technique comes from Dean Thomas. He's the kind of like
Dean's the man.
Yeah, he's the engineer behind a lot of whatever I do. And he kind of devised this way of going for the neck and just off balancing opponents and attacking the throat. And we've been drilling it for years and years and years. And even like, I feel like the way he's described it to me hasn't really clicked until like recently, where we've been drilling it for years, and now it's like, all right, I kind of get this.
Yeah, it's the way you do it is it's so brilliantly like the way it progresses. What's beautiful to watch, like especially the Rose match in particular, is like the squeeze that you put, like the progression of it is what you want to see at a really high level. That's what you want to see. And when someone executes and executes it on someone who is champion of the UFC, it's really incredible. I mean, that was an amazing showcase for you.
Oh, yeah, and into MMA, it just plays in perfectly. Like, my last fight with Piera Rodriguez, I was in mount throwing elbows the whole time, and every time she tried to turn her back a little bit, her coaches are like, no, don't give your back. So they're just making her lay on the ground and take elbows to the face instead of giving up her back. So I'm like, it's your, you know, the worst of two worlds there. Like, you get your choice.
Do you have, is the rest of your game as strong as your choke game?
I think so. I think my top pressure in jiu-jitsu is definitely something that a lot of girls especially haven't. Even a lot of guys, I feel like I get a lot of compliments that I feel like in the jiu-jitsu world, it's the only place where you can tell a girl she's heavy and it's a compliment, you know?
Right. You got heavy hips. What?
Yeah. Everybody tells me that I'm really heavy, and I feel like it's that kind of top pressure which is going to be dominant in an MMA game.
Yeah, it absolutely can be. I mean, you look at the guys from Dagestan, the Khabib disciples, Islam Makhachev, Khabib, those guys, they just crush you. They get on top of you and crush you. And when you see where really good, you know, high-level submission artists get smushed by guys like Khabib, you're like, wow. Like, that's some crazy. It's like there's layers and layers to everything. And we didn't know the layer of, like, controlling the legs with the legs until Khabib came along and did it. And when he would do it so thoroughly, you'd be like, Jesus Christ. He does this to everybody. Like, he didn't even have a bad moment. you know, until like there was like I get the Gleison Tibau fight was a pretty close fight, I believe, and then one round with Connor, but it, even that round was like a round he took off, you know, it's like that guy. But the squeeze that guy had, it's like everybody that trains with him says you don't understand, like you understand. It's like he weighs 400 pounds, like it doesn't even make any sense.
Yeah, that top control is just completely different. And it's like, I always say, I'm like, people hit a lot less. Like, they don't hit as hard when they're on their back.
Right.
So
of course.
I'd rather have somebody on their back than standing face to face with me, you know?
And you're draining them.
Exactly.
It's exhausting. That person carrying your weight, it's exhausting. You're always moving to try to defend. It's very difficult to get out of. And especially with someone, if it's a superior grappler in the scramble, she's going to take your back.
Exactly. Always looking for the submissions, the strikes. And if I'm on bottom, it's the strike, sweep, submit, or stand up. You know, we're just working for the finish constantly.
Well, that's what I love about your style. And I think that's what makes it so fan friendly, too. It's so exciting. I love the technique. The technique is so sharp. But you were saying something that I wanted to ask you to elaborate on. You said you don't even go for the hooks. You're so concerned with the choke that you'll like take the choke even if you have no hooks and then get the hooks later.
The hooks aren't even like that's like last priority, or I don't need them even. I don't think I had any hooks when I choked Rose. But I have such a unique grip with my head and hand position on my choke. So it's just, it doesn't really matter. That's where my control point is. It's not on the lower half of the body. It's on the choke. And usually when I have the choke before I get the hooks in, it's like people aren't ready to defend it. Usually you put the hooks in and people are already here. And now you have to hand fight and you're there for who knows how long.
Right.
Where if I get my choke first, then it's like if I need the hooks for control, I can get them in. But you're already choking, so you're worried about that.
So is this Dean's coaching? Did he coach you to do it this way?
Oh, yeah. He definitely came up with a whole game plan of that where it's just going for the choke just opportunistically.
Wow. Just because you're so good at it.
I feel like literally I've worked with Dean since day one. So I think it's he kind of also just molded this game plan for me.
That's awesome. He's the second best dressed guy in MMA. It's like just like a neck and neck with him and Bruce Buffer. But I think you got to give the nod to Buffer.
Yeah, I think you have to give it to Buffer.
He has such crazy suits. He has suits with like pictures of Elvis inside of him and shit. He's like every suit is weirder. They're crazy. They're so beautiful too. They're all perfectly tailored.
Oh yeah.
He must have 100,000 of them. I mean, how many fucking suits does that guy have?
He changes multiple times now too.
Oh, he's like a maniac.
Main card suit.
Yeah.
Undercard suit.
Bro, his tailor must be balling. Because it's all custom made shit.
Look at this one.
It's beautiful. Oh, that's Miami? What's in there?
It's him.
What's all the thing?
Oh, Vegas.
Vegas. Oh, it's all him. He's his own lining of his own jacket.
Yeah, it's a comic book or something.
How dope is it, though, that when that guy yells your name?
I know. Literally, last fight, I had to think to myself, I'm like, all right, that's Bruce Buffer. Just focus on the fight. Like, just think about Pierre right now.
Is it weird?
It's definitely weird. I don't know. Everything is weird about this for me. It's just like, I'm just like, I guess a socially awkward kind of don't really put myself out there. Well, I do with fighting, but it's like I've never really put myself out there in life. So it's like to be in these kind of positions, it's all a lot for me.
Wow. Well, it's amazing that the way you handle fighting, you could handle this the same way you handle fighting. You just get comfortable with it.
I think that, I don't know, for me, social situations are a lot harder than like fighting situations.
Wow. That's crazy.
Oh, yeah. Like,
has it always been like that?
100%.
Since you were a child?
Yeah. I feel like I've always been like the like socially awkward kid in the back of the class, like the nerd. Well, I still am, like at the gym. But, I volunteered with animals my whole life. I volunteered at like the Humane Society, a horse rescue, wildlife rehab. Just like animals were my thing, and then it was just kind of left field. I started kickboxing when I was 16,
just for fun.
Yeah, I really don't know where it came, like what the idea was, but
where'd you start? What gym?
At Dean's gym.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Wow. You got lucky.
So, exactly. One of Dean's pro fighters worked for my dad. So I wanted to start kickboxing, and then my dad found out that this guy was a pro fighter for Dean, so he ended up finding his gym, and that was the first gym I started at.
Wow. Wow, what a great place to start. And so then you start kickboxing, and how long before you decide, well, what about this MMA stuff? How long was that?
I think it was probably like 4 or 5 months before I started taking the MMA class there. But I wasn't like thinking about fighting. It was just there was a kid who was on the wrestling team at my high school who started training at Dean's gym. And he was like, oh, why don't you take the MMA class? And I thought, okay, I'll have a partner. Why don't I try it? And I just kept on doing it. And then I was training like every day for like 3 hours a night, you know? And they're like, all right, well, why don't we just get you a fight at this point?
Wow. What was it about fighting and martial arts that you became so obsessed with?
I really think it was I don't know what it was at first, because I didn't start jiu-jitsu, especially in the gi, until like a year after I started training. But when I started gi jiu-jitsu, I fell in love with that 100%, where it's just the technique of it and the little tiny details of jiu-jitsu that matter so much. Like if you put your thumb on this side of the hand or on this side of the hand, mm-hmm. it makes a huge difference. It's like the little tiny techniques that can make the difference, where now a 115-pound girl at the time could do whatever she wanted to a 200-pound guy. You know, I was manhandling these guys around the room. And I'm like, just because of these techniques that I learned. And I thought that was awesome.
Yeah, that is an amazing thing. It's jiu-jitsu is the one martial art that delivers as promised, where the smaller trained person can defeat the larger untrained person. Whereas a lot of other martial arts, I mean, you have a better chance, but when they're really big, you know, and some guy's swinging, if he knows how to punch a little bit and you get clubbed with one of those giant hams, you get fucked up. But if you get into a struggle, like some sort of a scramble, and you knock into some chairs, and all of a sudden you get a hold of this person, well, now he's fucked. That's what's crazy. It's like that a small person can physically control and submit a much stronger person regularly. It happens all the time. It happens with black belts.
Even in striking, it's like a person cannot know anything, but if they're big enough, they throw right. their hand the right way, they can knock you out.
Yeah. If you get hit with Francis Ngannou's pinky, you're in trouble.
Exactly.
You know, there's certain people that they're so powerful. Like the idea that you're going to stand and trade with them is crazy. They're going to hit you once and you're dead. You know, that's like, it just doesn't work that well.
Jiu-jitsu, it's just there's not the variant of space. Right. So there's not that element of like guessing, where it's mm-hmm. like I can control and I can feel what you're going to do by touching you. It's like it makes it a lot easier. You're not guessing with that space of striking.
You're also not guessing the variables, like how fast is this person? How fast am I accustomed to people punching me? Is this person much faster? Do I have to anticipate that? Because if you ever see like street fight videos, the most horrific ones are some poor asshole who wants to start a fight with someone who's a trained fighter, and the trained fighter fucks him up. But you could see like they have no idea how fast things can happen. Like I'm sure you've seen the Joe Schilling one.
Yes,
the Joe Schilling one's ridiculous. But there's no way that guy could have known that could happen that quickly. There's no way.
And like, people don't expect, like for someone like me, a lot of times I get, I would never guess that you're a fighter. For someone like Joe Schilling, it's still even like, oh, yeah, you wouldn't, like, just
looks
see
like
him.
An axe murderer.
But you just see him walking around. And, like, most people, you don't expect that they're.
Joe Schilling, you don't expect
well,
it?
I don't know,
looks
with
like
him,
a probably, psycho to me.
Yeah, yeah. But say, like, Ryan Hall.
Ryan Hall is a great example.
Yeah. You don't expect him to be a fighter, but it's like, you never know what somebody's capable of when it comes to sports like this.
Oh, for sure, with jiu-jitsu. Mikey Musumeci.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
That's the best example. Yeah. Mikey is a stone-cold killer. And he looks like a guy who comes over to fix your computer. Like he looks like the friendliest super nerd.
This video.
Oh, this video's horrible. This is a street fight in a parking garage. Have you seen this?
No.
These guys start fucking with this dude in a parking garage. The guy's trying to get away. No, he fucked the other guy up before this.
This is the shorter version.
Okay, this is the shorter version. So this guy, he's like, come on, you want some? And he moves forward. This guy leg kicks him. And then this is where it gets ugly. Punches him. Bam.
He's out.
Yeah, you don't want that. Like, what? Like, it's awesome to see that stuff works, right, for people. Like, hey, this is real. Someone tries to attack you, you have an upper hand. But also, like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
These fucking people.
I've never been in a street fight in my life.
Good for you.
I'm like, I don't intend to ever, but it's just, I don't get it. Like, yeah, there's, I don't see a use for fighting outside the cage for me. Like,
it's a lot of people with anger management issues. And then there's criminals, too. And, you know, bad folks.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. There's a lot of weird stuff in the world. But I just, for me, I think it's fascinating that you are more afraid of social interaction than you're afraid of cage fighting. That might be one of the greatest lines that anyone has ever said. I think that's going to get you a lot of fans. For real.
For me, it's just like literally I never really did any kind of interviews or media or anything like that until I got in the tough house. So that's going from absolutely zero to 100%. Like,
what was that like? You were like 22 at the time?
Yeah, I was 22 and I was having interviews every day, cameras on you 24/7. Literally after every single interview, I had to go and change my shirt because I'd be dripping sweat like I just got out the sauna.
Whoa.
Just so nervous after every single interview.
Do you think they brought you into the house knowing that you were nervous too? That like that you're a little socially awkward in that regard and like that maybe that would make good television?
I guess I never thought of it in that way.
Obviously they brought you in because you're skillful.
Yeah.
But they also cast that show as a reality show. It's a very cleverly done show. You know, like it's smart the way they do it. They like even with what they're doing now with Conor McGregor and Michael Chandler, it's great, but perfect shit talking when Conor tells him you'll do as you're told. It's amazing. Kale, I hope that fight takes place, but it's such a show, right? So it's not just an athletic competition. It's also they want to make sure the people are fun.
Oh yeah, our season seemed pretty like tame though. I feel like in general we had a lot of. There is me and Montana De La Rosa were the two, like, younger girls. And then everybody else, I feel like, was, like, older and more mature. Like, around, like, at least, like, 30s. And, like, they were, like, I don't know. Nobody was trying to start drama. Nobody was trying to, like, get in each other's faces. Or we didn't have any altercations. It was, like, it was a pretty chill season.
That's great. So no one ever encourages, like, any bickering or anything like that? They don't ever tell you, hey, you know, this bitch has been saying some shit. Does anybody ever do that?
No, nobody ever really does anything like that. But it's just like the boredom gets to you, if anything else. It's like, I feel like...
No phones, right?
No phones, no TV, no music, no books, no nothing.
No books.
Nothing at
all. Oh, my God. Nothing?
So it's like...
Can you have a notebook?
You're allowed to get a notebook. And then they gave us... We asked for coloring books and they gave us sketch pads.
Oh my God, I think I would go nuts. That sounds like one of those like anti-tech retreats, you know?
Exactly.
Where they try to weed people off their tech addictions.
I was just talking to one of the boys who's actually on the Conor McGregor season over the weekend, and he said the exact same thing as me. He's like, it was the best and worst experience of my life. Because it's like when you're in the gym, there's so many highs. It's so great. But then when you go back to the house, you're just sitting there for hours and you're bored and it sucks.
What do you guys do to kill time? Can you play games? Do they have like – they used to have pool, right?
Yeah. I think they had a pool table and a chess table. And then they have like the list where you can order anything.
Oh. So you could order like Monopoly?
Yeah. So we would order a bunch of bullshit. Just try and entertain ourselves.
God. Did you have good conversations? Or was it weird because you're all competitors?
It's weird. Well, not because we're competitors, because I'm weird.
That's awesome.
I'm like, I felt like I, especially back then, I wasn't able to just like, I don't know, acclimate to that. Going into a house with 16 different girls that I don't really know.
Right. Yeah, a completely alien experience. And you're feeling a little bit awkward, and you're also 22. And then also, bam, now you're on TV.
And it's my first time, like, really, like, leaving home, I would say, you know, for a long period of time. So it was definitely a big experience, like, a lot to take on.
How long ago was that now?
6 years?
6 years. So would you say that now you're entering into your fighting prime? Do you think that's happening right now?
Oh, yeah. I think this is like just the beginning of my prime. I'm just getting into where I've really found the right combination for everything. And I feel like I'm just getting better every fight.
Are you ranked right now in the where are you at?
My next fight is against the number 15 girl, Tabitha Ricky.
Interesting. She's tough. That'll be fun. That'll be a good one.
Yeah, I'm like, it's coming up quick, June 24th.
Oh, wow. That is quick. How many would you – what is, like, your ideal camp size, like, in terms of weeks?
I would say probably about 6 to 8 weeks. I like just to get focused on that opponent, really start breaking down their style and game planning for them specifically. But it's like with the UFC, you never know what you're getting.
Right. Like, how often do they call you last minute?
I've gotten a handful of last minute ones, and then I feel like it's almost just as bad getting like the ones 16 weeks out and things like that, because you're just sitting there waiting for so long.
Or you run the risk of overtraining.
Yeah. Well,
have you ever done that? Where you peaked too early in a camp?
I feel like I train year round no matter what. So it's like it's never really like we push it the last couple weeks, but that's about it. So.
Really? So you're just always training so hard that you can essentially take – well, that's great if you want to take a short notice fight.
Yeah.
Because you're always prepared.
I train probably about 4 or 5 hours in the morning and about an hour at night, even if I'm off camp. Like in camp, out of camp, it doesn't matter.
Wow.
On the same schedule.
It's just obsession.
Yeah. I got nothing better to do.
But, I mean, what an amazing way to get better. You know, I mean, like when you think about grappling and you think about Gordon Ryan, no one doubts that he's the best no-gi grappler ever, right? But no one also doubts that he works 365 days a year. Like, that's an insane work schedule, and these are insane results. And you're essentially doing that in MMA.
That's what I think you see with, like, a lot of black belts or, like, people who are at a high level is they stop drilling. They stop doing the stuff that, like, Gordon Ryan still drills every day, and that's why he's so good at what he does. And it's like people at a high level in MMA, they're just doing what the black belts do and sitting on the side until it's time to roll, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like you got to be drilling every day. You got to be putting in the hours. Like, my coaches are there with me every hour of the day if I wanted for them to be, you know? They're willing to put in the work. And like I said, as fighters, we got nothing better to do. Literally, this is what we do. Like, you got to treat it as like you're going to school, a doctorate, you know?
Well, I think that approach, your approach is perfect. That's the right way to do it. I really do. I mean, but everybody's different, you know? So people have like different ways of fighting, different ways of approaching fighting. Some are much more chaotic than like you and your style. But I think that's the best way to look at it. And I think too often people love to roll because rolling's so fun. It's so fun that you just don't even want to do all that other stuff. You know, let me get warmed up a little bit and let's fucking go. Let's go. You just want to go because it's so exciting. It's the most fun thing and it's exercise. So it's like engaging intellectually, it's physically, it's emotionally engaging. It's like sometimes you're like, fuck, like you're going to tap and you don't. And there's a lot going on. There's battles going on. And it's a great workout. And if you can do it, and if you could do it on a regular basis, it could change your life. It could change your life. And it's available to everybody. Like this idea that it's all brutes. When you go to 10th Planet Jiu-Jitsu, you see these like dudes look like skateboarders and surfers, and they'll strangle you. It's weird. It's like they're super nerd assassins. There's a ton of them, and you're one of them on the female side.
Yeah, I feel like that's I don't know. For me, it's like I said, I've never been like someone athletic. I volunteered with animals growing up, you know? I was always the quiet kid in the back of the class, and it's like just I don't know, with jiu-jitsu, it's being able to be that like I don't know, be that voice in a way, you know, being that way to express myself. And it's, I feel like it was just like completely not who I was when I was little, you know, it's a complete out of left field.
But it's you, you know, you're just growing, you know, this is the new you, right? I mean, it is you.
Yeah.
And you're going to, if you continue and you become champion, you're going to have to do a lot of this shit.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to have to do a lot of this shit. You know, I mean, how many fights do you think you are away from a title shot? It's a stacked division.
I don't think I'm too far away from it currently. I think that after this fight, I would like – I'm not looking past Tabitha at all, but I'm also like looking at the trajectory of where I'm going. And obviously Mackenzie Dern just put on a great performance a couple weeks ago. And she has the second most submissions in women's history, and I have the first. So it's like, I think I would like to, you know, just solidify that. Everybody calls her the submission queen, even though I'm like, I have more than her.
Well, she's pretty awesome, but you are too. That would be a crazy fight.
Oh, yeah, and I think then that after that fight, I wouldn't be too far away from the title fight.
I was very impressed with her against Angela Hill. Angela Hill is so tough. She was taking so many shots. Like, oh, my God. And just kept fight, would not give up that armbar. Like, so many times, Mackenzie came so close to getting that armbar, and Angela was just not giving up. But, oof.
I think that's the best Mackenzie we've seen so far.
Ever. Just like... it was incredible. Incredible performance. And super aggressive, too.
Exactly. Like, that's what I feel like was so beneficial for her. She doesn't have to worry about getting taken down, typically, you know? So she can be a little bit reckless and come in with those strikes. And that's exactly what she needed to do with Angela Hill, and she was able to do it.
And she's dangerous on her feet now, too. It used to be just the ground. But now she's winging bombs. And she hit Angela with a knee. You know, she's very dangerous.
He says she doesn't have to be scared, you know, so she can throw, overcommit to any strike, throw with all her power, and it doesn't matter because it's like, put me on my back. Like, thank you. Yeah. Like, come into my guard.
Yeah, there's guards, you know, and then some, I mean, her guard is fucking nasty. Her guard is so high level. Everything she does is so high level. It's like when you can watch jiu-jitsu like that in MMA, like a real world champion, when it goes to the ground, like her, like moving from position to position to position to finally securing it, it's like, woof. It's so quick. She's so good. So good and so technical. You know, her dad's a legend. It's just like that kind of like high level jiu-jitsu in MMA is some of my favorite shit to watch. You know, there's certain people that just have – either one or two elite high level moves that they could pull off, and when they do it, you just like, you're doing this to the best of the best in the world.
Yeah, I feel like with jiu-jitsu it's just like I don't know, just moving with people so much. I feel like it's so impressive to watch how people can just float on top of people. Mm-hmm. It's like knowing when to control and when to release, almost, you know, when you really need it. I don't. Some people are specialists at control, but like for someone like me, I feel like I'm better at flowing, you know, and letting people fall, make their own mistakes, and fall into things. Whereas like someone like Khabib is that pressure kind of fighter.
Right, you're better at finding the openings as you threaten them in different areas and just move into position and hold it.
Or not necessarily me threatening them, but them falling into their own mistake.
Oh.
I feel like I like to, like, I'm just sitting there doing damage until I see the opening, until I see my opportunity, until I see that one mistake that you made and I capitalize on it.
And is this how you've always done it, or is this something you're doing now better than you've ever done before?
This is something I'm definitely doing now better than I've ever done before.
Was this the same approach that you had in the beginning of your career when you first started?
I don't think as much, just because now I feel like I went from a jiu-jitsu girl who did MMA to an MMA fighter more.
Mm.
Where it's like now, I don't know, like a lot of my early submissions were arm bars off my back, where I was just comfortable playing guard. I didn't care because I was good at jiu-jitsu. Where it's like now I'm always looking to do damage wherever I'm at. Typically, like to sit on top and do heavy ground and pound and heavy top pressure until they're like, all right, we need to get this girl off me. I need to stand up. And then that's when I capitalize. Typically, a lot of times off the stand up is where I find my choke. Or if they're just staying on their back is where my arm bar open up. Or like head and arms, other opportunities where I just don't like to give up that top position.
Yeah, top position is so important. It's just if you can control the top, it's just much easier for you than it is for the other pro. And it's also kind of humiliating. Someone's on top of you in front of all these people punching you in the face.
It's also just a lot to carry on top of you. It makes it, you gasp, makes it heavy. Yeah. And that, like, I feel like nobody understands the cardio that it takes to get up and get down and get up and get down in MMA versus, like, if you're just doing jiu-jitsu or you're just doing kickboxing rounds. It's like once you mix it all together, it's just – it changes the pace.
Clearly, yeah. I remember one of the most brilliant things that when George St. Pierre fought BJ Penn. He wanted to grapple with him immediately. He wanted to really get a hold of him right away to wear his arms out. He goes, I wanted his arms to be filled with blood. So, like, it changes it. Changes your ability to throw punches. Changes your ability to get snap off, to explode. You're kind of gassed out because you've been pummeling and trying to avoid being taken to the ground. It's just this – when people don't know when they see, like, your fights, these exchanges against the cage. Those are some of the most grueling moments in all of MMA. Just the battle to see who wins this thing.
Yeah, exactly. Especially against the cage. Honestly, a lot of those battles, I'm just like, if we can find an opportunity to break off, I'm willing to. Because it's like, if I didn't get the takedown initially, then I'm just going to be grueling. Like you said, like it's going to be hard work to get them down.
Yeah.
Where it's like, let's break off, reset, and find the opportunity, find the right timing for the takedown instead of sitting here and just grinding it out and just tiring both of us out.
It's such an interesting time for MMA because you're seeing people like yourself that are young and grew up with it and got to watch it on television and got it. What was the first MMA fight that you ever saw?
I think the first one that I ever watched was John Jones and I think it was Rashad Evans.
So you are watching it at a very high level, as opposed to a lot of the people that, like even John Jones. The stuff he got to see was stuff from 10 years before that. And like the kids of today, the kids like yourself, like you, the people growing up now, you guys have the most amazing library of champions to study in all the different forms of martial arts. And to see people like yourself that are putting it together so obsessively and to watch it succeed over and over again inside the octagon, it's fucking cool. I love it. It's such an exciting time.
I feel like it's the beginning of MMA as a sport, where it's like for so long it's been jiu-jitsu guys who do a little bit of striking or like like wrestlers or strikers. But now it's like it's people putting it together and making styles and systems based upon these things.
Yeah.
Where it's like I feel like honestly Dean's one, obviously I work with him, but he's one of the best in trying to innovate, and that's why I appreciate his mind so much of just trying to make it MMA as a sport whenever he's on the techniques that he has me drilling, where I feel like it's like Danaher innovated the no-gi game with leg locks. It's like we need to change this from being kickboxing, jiu-jitsu, and wrestling to being mixed martial arts.
Dean always has awesome input whenever we're doing the shows and that they cut to him. He'll always point out something that I probably missed. And when you're watching these high-level people that are coming up right now, there is still the room for the specialist. There's still the room for, like, the Anderson Silva-style striking. The problem is with all fights is they all start standing up. And if you are standing up with a guy like Alex Pereira, like, you're in a world of danger. This is a terrifying world. Like, so there are still those specialists that are so goddamn dangerous at this one aspect of the game that they can get through. And the problem with, like, I always wonder, will there be, like, because Israel is a striking specialist too, but will there be an MMA fighter that is complete everywhere to the point where they can stand with a world champion kickboxer? Is that a real thing, or is that only a few freaks? Or is that it seems like in order to be a world champion kickboxer, you have to really dedicate yourself only to striking. The timing that's involved, the distance. No, you're not thinking about takedowns. You're not thinking about anything else. For you to be a world champion MMA fighter, you have to be well-versed in so many different things. Do you really have the time to dedicate to get to the kickboxing level that this guy is? And every fight starts kickboxing. Every fight starts way apart from each other. And when you got a guy like Pereira moving towards you with that crazy style, you're like, oh, Jesus Christ, you know? Or Adesanya, like, standing in front of you, moving, and you're like, this motherfucker has me three moves ahead. We haven't even started exchanging yet.
Yeah, I guess you got to hope to get those guys on their back quick,
know.
You know?
That's what I'm saying. But it's interesting to watch, like, the evolution of Robert Whittaker. You know, because Robert Whittaker, you know, he evolved so much more from the first fight to the second fight. He got so much better.
Yeah, no, I don't know. It's definitely when you have a good striker, it's hard to obviously, like we discussed earlier with the space. You know, you can never guess what's going to happen. But it's just like I feel like if you are a good grappler or a good wrestler and you are able to get it to the mat, you can be that much more effective than having a good striker in front of you.
Yes. Well, you certainly can. The difference is you can control what's happening if you can get someone and you get on top of them, right? What I always wonder is, like, I wonder if there are the people like Bejeda or of that ilk, Cedric Doumbé, who I think is now going to fight for PFL. Have you ever seen that guy fight?
No.
Holy shit. He's a glory world champion kickboxer, and he's a bad man. And he has a crazy work ethic, too. He used my gym when he was in town, and he has a coach. And they do these strength and conditioning routines. Excuse me. Get something else. They do these strength and conditioning routines where it's like one round of sprinting on the one of those self-propelled treadmills, and then one round of going hard on the bag, and then one round of plyos, and they're just rotating back and forth between all these different exercises. His cardio is off the charts, and he's like, that's it. That's the game plan. The game plan is you put heat on them with technique and athleticism and tech and strategy, but you put heat on them, they can't keep up. They just can't, because they're not going to work that hard. If you get to that level of fitness, like, you can have this extra thing that other people just don't have. And Cedric Doumbé has that extra thing. But can he wrestle? Like, is he going to be able to stuff takedowns? How are these guys going to deal with getting him to the ground? Because as you're moving in on him, you could get any second you get knocked unconscious. It could come out of nowhere, and he might just take a wild shot at you because he doesn't want to get taken down. Maybe he says, let's see. Let me just throw a head kick. You know, it's like, I like watching that too. I love watching someone like yourself. I love watching these MMA fighters of today. They're these full, complete artists. Get some of his highlights, not the training highlights, but I know he's been doing a lot of MMA training. But go to his kickboxing highlights. His kickboxing highlights are preposterous. He's a bad man. And he's got some vicious knockouts. And he's just clever in there. He's just clever. I love the way. And then he's fighting that guy's Nicky Holtzkin, who's a beast. I mean, Doumbé is and constant pressure. Like, you don't get breaks with him. If you get a break, it's because he wants you to have a break. I mean, he just swarms on dudes.
I just feel like if you look at that pressure in MMA, it's like it would be impossible to maintain with the variable of takedowns.
Look at that. It would be impossible.
Yeah.
You're true. It's absolutely. Watch this when he misses. Look at this.
Just chilling.
He's actually a comedian.
Oh, wow.
He's a comedian in France.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's crazy.
That's
and he's
crazy,
one of the
yeah.
best kickboxers alive.
Multi-talented.
Very multi-talented. Super funny guy, too. And he, you know, if he can figure out the grappling, my question is always, like, is it better to be well-rounded or is it better to be a specialist? I used to think it'd be better to be a specialist wrestler. I felt like, and I still think that to a certain extent, that at least the base beginning of amateur wrestling, those guys seem to be the toughest. They have the most mental fortitude. The grind of becoming a successful wrestler is unlike any other athletic pursuit that I only wrestled in high school for 1 year. It's one of the hardest things in my life. It's fucking hard. But these guys it's particularly good at the most important thing, getting the fight to the ground and getting on top of people, right? That's the number one thing. Those guys are the best at it. So I felt like that's like the cornerstone. But every fight does start standing up. And so then you get a guy like Mirko Krokop, who figures out how to stuff takedowns, and now you're dealing with one of the most elite kickboxers alive. And it's horrifying, right? So I always wonder, like, what is the best approach? Do you think it's to be a fully rounded mixed martial artist, putting all your time in all these different things? Or do you think maybe there's some room for the idea of, like, the world champion specialist?
I think it's best to focus on everything, try to make yourself a mixed martial artist. I think if you are a specialist to begin with, say like someone like him who's a world champion kickboxer, you probably shouldn't be investing all your time into jiu-jitsu at that point. You should probably stay the specialist, you know, like go to MMA and like learn how to defend takedowns. You shouldn't be learning like how to finish arm bars necessarily, you know, right. putting a gi on day one. It's like you don't need to learn that at this point. You should focus on what you're good at. But if you are day one, I think you should like focus on everything and putting everything all together, because it's like I can have someone who is a better wrestler than me, but I can guarantee you they won't want to stay in my guard. You know,
right.
It's like for me especially, I think the two most important are striking and jiu-jitsu, because they are the finishing elements. So it's like those are the ways I can take people out of the fight, where it's like wrestling, I can control a little bit more, but I don't have any finishing options.
Well, that's a brilliant way of looking at it. I think you're right. I think if you're starting from the beginning, I think learning everything would be very advantageous, because you wouldn't want to think you wouldn't want to think you're safer than you are, and then someone takes you down at will, and you're like, oh, Jesus. You know, like, if you just learn martial arts, like striking martial arts, and you don't
maybe
know.
Maybe I should learn jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, maybe I need to learn a little bit of
stuff.
That's
probably not the moment to learn.
No. But I do think there's some room for people that, at least if you come, maybe it's like if you get to a certain age, maybe at a certain age you must go all in on all MMA. But if you could be a specialist early in your life, like if you're a specialist in striking, I think, maybe early in your life, you would have a – like if you look at all the best kickboxers and even all the best boxers for the most part, a lot of them start when they're very young. It seems to be like striking for some reason. I think there's freaks. There's people that just learn it, and even when they're in their 30s, they can learn it and they get really good at it. But for a lot of people, there's something about the timing of striking that if you don't pick it up when you're really young, you don't really achieve this sort of – there's like a plateau for a lot of folks. Have you ever noticed that?
For me, I'm like, striking has never been like my forte. I started striking before I started jiu-jitsu. It's just jiu-jitsu just clicked for me. Striking, I feel like it just takes that little bit more of like athleticism, I guess, mm-hmm. where it's like I'm not the most athletic fighter. So it's like I feel like I can't really use my mind to just make quicker decisions in striking as much as I can in jiu-jitsu, where it's easier to.
Well, that's a brilliant way to do it. I think, you know, especially for your mind and your approach, striking is just a means to an end, right? You're trying to strangle people.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, I'm not going to say I'm never going to have a knockout, because obviously that's the goal, is to be able to develop power. But it's so much easier for like a heavyweight to just throw his fist and knock somebody out, where someone, a girl, like, any of the 25ers, 15ers, the smaller girls, it's like it's really hard to develop that kind of power unless you're born with it.
Well, that's why Valentina is so scary. Valentina Shevchenko, when she landed that head kick on Jessica Eye, I was like, that was nasty.
Oh, yeah. Nasty knockouts like that with girls, I feel like it's just – they're not common. So when you see them, it's like you got to have respect for that girl.
Yeah. Well, Valentina, that fucking left high kick. Holy shit. And she set it up to the body before that. She's so good. And she's always like light on her toes. You know, her style is so interesting. You know, it's a very – it's like when she – you know, she lost the title now, obviously, and I would love to see the rematch because the fight was awesome. But – if you look at her, like the best moments in her career, she's like always moving, always on her toes, perfect technique with striking.
Oh, yeah, she's rarely out of position. I feel like that's one of the things I've always admired about her. It's like it's hard to do what Alexa did, is to be able to get her out of position and be able to capitalize on it, get her to like mentally not be there for a split second and be able to see that opportunity.
Isn't it crazy that she did it off a spinning back kick?
I feel like Valentina was just kind of like, this chick won't go away. I thought this was going to be easier. And she started making like not the smartest decisions.
You really think that's what happened? You don't think maybe it was just fatigue?
I think a little bit of that, but a little bit of frustration maybe too. Just like Valentina was winning the fight and had a lot of good opportunities. But Alexa was the only one walking in there knowing that she was going to win that fight no matter what that night.
Well, is that real? Can you know that you're going to win no matter what? You could have that attitude. You could say afterwards, I knew I was going to win no matter what. But that's two world titles that were essentially lost to a spinning back kick miss. Do you ever see Chris Weidman? When Chris Weidman fought Luke Rockhold, he was winning the fight. It was like a really good fight. And then he throws a spinning back kick. And he misses, and Luke Rockhold takes him to the ground and beats the fuck out of him. And it was a horrible beating. It was a really dominant performance by Rockhold. It was hard to watch. And that he lost the title. And then you look at Valentina, same thing. Spinning back kick, misses. Alexa Grasso gets her back, chokes her. Crazy. It's like two world titles on a spinning back kick miss.
I feel like it was just like, I don't know, it wasn't a smart thing. It was just like a lapse of thought for her for that second where she was just like, all right, I'm going to throw this, and Alexa just capitalized. She saw the opportunity and took it.
Well, if she landed it, then it would have been something different. She has a nasty spinning back kick. She really does. So this is Wyman, and they were in the middle of this fight. Wyman was moving forward on Rockhold. And this is a Wyman was the fucking man. This was a tough fight. Very tough fight. But Wyman's putting all this pressure on him, kicks him to the body. Looks like he's putting it to him. Head kick. So right there. One, it's like he's beating him up, like he's big brothering him, right? And he throws a lazy wheel kick. And he gets taken down. And now Luke Rockhold's a motherfucker on the ground. And that boy's big. Luke Rockhold's big. You know, he makes 185 for about 15 seconds.
Yeah.
He's well into the 200s, I'm sure, when he's fighting. He's a big fellow. Big, long, strong as shit with crazy top pressure. And so here you go. Wyman's exhausted now, and they can't believe he's in this position. It's a terrible position to be in. I mean, Rockhold's training with DC. He's training with Khabib. He's training with all those people down there, all those animals in AKA. Cain Velasquez. It's just a savage soup down there.
Yeah,
AKA.
Exactly.
And so Luke Rockhold, people forget. You know, people see some of his losses and see him in the later stages of his career. When Luke Rockhold was a champ, and this right here that he won the title, this motherfucker had staph. He came into this fight on antibiotics. He just gotten over staph. You know how hard it is to get over antibiotics. Fuck you up. And to be winning this fight in this way is fucking incredible. And all off of Wyman missing one shot, really. Look, I mean, he's just beating the shit out of him. It's hard to watch, man, because Wyman is like really kind of helpless at this point. And he's so battered from these elbows that it's like, and he's too tough. He's so tough, the guy will never quit. And so this is one where I'm like, maybe this could have been stopped earlier. You could stop this at any second right here. You know what I'm saying? Like, don't you think?
It keeps going, too.
Bro, this is crazy. Oh, no, this is crazy.
That might have been the round.
Unbelievable punishment dish out.
I think it was the round, even. I think they keep going.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
What?
Again with that kick to the body by Wyden.
It went on after that. That's right. Yeah. That's right. And it gets, oh, my God, it happens again, though.
Yeah,
it happens again. After that's that, right.
Last round.
Oh. How tough is Chris Weidman? That motherfucker is so tough. Whew. But sometimes careers can change off of one missed technique, which is one of the wildest things about MMA. Careers can change.
Oh, yeah. Anything can happen at any moment. I feel like it's like I say, you can go in and you can be a better striker than the person. You can just get caught. It can be their night. They can show up better. It's like there's a lot of my fights where it's like I feel like I am the better fighter, but they showed up that night.
It's always a learning process, though, right? Like every experience that you have, you're putting into your mental database of like how to deal with different conditions, how to deal with different thoughts that come in your head.
Oh, yeah. I feel like it's a huge learning process. And for me, I think like I didn't really get a lot of regional experience. You know, I was 3-2 when I came into the Tough House.
Wow.
So I'm going on my next fight will be my 15th UFC fight.
So go 3-2, Tough House. And then Liverpool.
Yeah, exactly.
That's so crazy. Oh, my God. What a wild ride.
Yeah, so a lot of my learning experience was in the UFC.
In the UFC in front of the whole world.
Yeah, exactly.
Chris Weidman, when he knocked out Anderson Silva, that was another one of those, how did that happen? What is going on moments? We're like, everybody thought that Anderson Silva was untouchable at that point. That was that moment where... You know, you realize, like, this sport is nuts. Even the people that you think are the greatest of all time, they can get cracked and knocked unconscious. Like, like Leon Edwards, when he knocked out Kamaru Usman in the last round, like, what? What? Kamaru? When he lands that head kick and you see Kamaru, who's, like, one of the most durable guys that's ever lived, he gets cracked. He gets back up. He seems fine always in every fight. And this one, he gets put out. It almost seemed surreal. Like when Tyson got knocked out by Buster Douglas. Like, what? Like, what is happening?
It's crazy. It's like you say, you can be the better fighter. You could win that fight 9 out of 10 times. And then just that one time is that night. That's what happens.
Especially at a high level, right?
Especially at a high level. It's like, you can't make any kind of mistake. It's like on a regional level, say you make a little mistake, but they're not going to capitalize on it because they're not smart enough, maybe, you know? It's like whatever it is. But then once you get up to a high level, it's like, these people are good. If you make that one little mistake, then you're getting knocked out. You're getting subbed. You don't have those kind of opportunities. So it's definitely a learning experience there.
There's also the difference between people that are fighting that train and people that train like you train. There's a big difference. The fact that you do it constantly and consistently, it's just such an advantage, I believe. Because, I know it just from training in jiu-jitsu. Even when I was training like 4 days a week, like really regularly, I would be in with those guys that are training 5, 6, 7 days a week, and they would be getting better than me. Like, and I knew it. You could tell. It's in your head. Like, okay, do you want to go psycho and be here 7 days a week? Or do you want to try to live a life? Like, how are you going to balance this? You know, they're going to get better than you. It's impossible to stop. It's just a thing that people do. If you can dedicate enough time and focus to something over long periods of time, if you really stay true to it, you get better and better and better. And when I see someone like yourself that does that and goes from the tough house and goes to that fight in Liverpool, to me, that's like one of the great American success stories. That was fucking – I mean, that's really amazing. It's an amazing thing to be this person who's a socially awkward kid, and then all of a sudden you strangle some girl in her hometown in front of the whole world in this crazy arena. Like, that's wild.
Oh, no, it's 100%. Everything is surreal about it to me. So it's like, for me, it's like I'm just a kid who loves this shit. I love this sport, and that's about it. I love showing up every day. I love going to the gym every day. And it's like, even on my bad days, it's better than going to any other job. Like, I love training more than anything else. Like, I can always remember, it's like, I've worked at vet's offices. I worked at Chili's right before I got into the tough house. And I'm like, there's my worst days at the gym are better than any day I had to go to one of those jobs.
Like, of course.
I remember like getting off of a shift at Chili's, getting off of a shift at the vet's office, working like 10 hours a day and just going straight to the gym. And there's nothing better than the feeling of the mats underneath your feet. Like,
wow.
That's just what I love more than anything.
You can't beat that kind of dedication. That dedication trumps everything. Because even if you're really, really disciplined, you're enthusiastic too. Like, there's like discipline will get you through like a 5 mile run, you know, but like you're not gonna learn as much just with discipline. Like, you kind of enthusiasm and discipline is really the right combination. You can't just be disciplined and just kind of trudge through it, because the person that's more interested in it, that's more passionate about it, more excited about it, that person's more jazzed up. They're gonna learn it quicker, and they're gonna put it on you quicker. It's like, it's the ultimate testing ground for ideas and focus. It really is.
I don't get people who don't train out of camp, or they're like, oh yeah, I took like a month off or something. Like, what did you do?
Do you do anything other than train? Like, what is fun time?
Nothing, really.
No hobbies? No nothing? You don't play golf? Oh, nothing?
I have I live in Miami, so it's like I'll go out like paddleboarding sometimes, things like that. But that's really it. Like, training is so much of my life, and I feel like it's like a lot of the times I'm not training, I just don't want to do anything because I'm tired. I'm exhausted from training.
Yeah, I think Masayama said that about his karate students. I think they were talking about why they don't – I think it's Masayama. It's not that they're more noble. They're tired from training. Something like that. I might have I'm pretty sure I fucked that up. But yeah, it's if you're training all the time, like that's why street fights seem so stupid. You know, like, oh my God, that's like more training. Like,
yeah, exactly.
More training with danger and weapons.
Yeah. No, I'm like, I don't get how people are so confident to get in street fights.
Crazy,
ever.
Right?
Like, that's like you said, without weapons. Like, that's the crazy thing to me. You don't know when somebody has a weapon.
They shoot people. People shoot people. Just be nice. It's not a fight.
Exactly.
There's so many fucking loons out there, though. Have you ever had like a girl come to the gym specifically to try to train with you?
To come train with me, yeah, definitely. I train at a smaller gym, the Goat Shed in Miami. So it's like
that is a wild place that you train at.
Yeah, it is.
I love that you train there. Those fellas are wild.
Yeah, my coach, awesome. He has like a controlled chaos going on in there.
But they're getting good.
Oh yeah,
everybody's getting good.
Like I said, we're there at 8 a.m., 10 a.m., 11 a.m. Then I'm doing cardio after. Everybody's there, focused, working. It's like I feel like people see all the crazy shit online and don't think we're actually training. We're actually working. But it's like there's so much technical like ability that's behind all the chaos that you guys see.
No, for sure. There's you could see that on Instagram. But if to the casual observer, I see what you're saying. But the infectious energy in that gym is so apparent that it comes out through Instagram. Like, that's how you know it's a legit gym. It's a little wild.
Bas Rutten.
Basito. He was just here.
Yeah, he was there.
He's the fucking man.
Last week, I want to say, we had a seminar.
He's the fucking man. I love that dude. Okay. Some girl had her legs open. I don't know what that was all about. Don't look at that one, Jamie. Yeah, Miami's a wild ass place.
It's actually not a bad post.
It's not?
It's clever.
Like
selling glasses.
Oh, you click it and it's something else? Oh, she's selling sunglasses. Oh, glasses. That's a genius.
You got to entice them, you know?
Yeah, there's a lot of dirty people out
get
there.
Get the clickbait.
I'm like, mm-hmm. What do you think about fighters starting OnlyFans? Is that nuts?
I don't know. It's not my thing, definitely. Like, obviously, like, I have friends who do it, things like that. But it's just, I don't know. I feel like you got to decide what you want. I feel like it's hard to be committed to fighting when you're into doing any. Like, if you taking pictures and looking cute and doing things like that, that takes time. Where it's like, I don't have time for that shit.
It's not just that. But then that probably makes you as much money as fighting.
Yeah, that's also a thing weird. About it, too. Or more money. There's a lot of girls making more money than fighting.
I'm sure there are. I'm not knocking it. If I was a girl, I'd be in my underwear for sure. I'd be like, come see this. Give me money. Especially if I was young. If you're a young girl, I mean, I'm not encouraging anyone to start an OnlyFans. But I am saying, like, what is worse? What is worse, someone looking at your butt or, you know, you having to work some stupid job for 4 months?
I can't remember who it was, but there's a girl, she had an OnlyFans and she was a fighter. And she tweeted once, she's like, you guys can pay me to use my body to fight people, but you don't want me to, like, pay me to use my body to, like, on OnlyFans. Like, you guys are
like
justifying.
Someone was telling her not to do it?
Yeah.
I don't believe in that. I don't think you should be able to tell anybody what to do with their personal life. Especially like social media, personal life, like do whatever you want to do. You want to show everybody your butt? Go ahead. You know, I mean, the thing is then your butt's on the internet for the rest of your life. And that's okay too. I think probably there's going to be no privacy in about a decade or so. I think we're going to be like, remember back in the day when you had privacy? I think people are going to know every thought that everybody has. There's nothing hiding. You're not going to be able to hide taxes. You're not going to be. I think the way our lives are getting more and more interconnected with technology, we're going to come to a point in time where I don't think there's going to be anything to hide that anybody has. And that's going to be a weird time to be alive.
I swear I think about things and my iPhone tells me. Like,
oh, yeah, for sure.
It's like, oh, why don't you order this? I'm like, how did you even? I swear I didn't say it out loud. I just thought of it and it comes up there.
I was Googling something and then the thing that I Googled started showing up in my Instagram feed. Very specific. It's a very specific thing. I'll tell you what it is. It's a 1968 Bullitt Mustang. Tell me how specific that is. That's really fucking specific. That never showed up in my Instagram feed before. But I was Googling the scene from the movie Bullet. You ever heard of the scene, the movie?
Yeah.
It's Steve McQueen movie. It's filmed in San Francisco. It's the greatest car chase scene ever. And Steve McQueen has this 1968 Highland Green Mustang. And they're going through this. See if you can find it. It's fucking wild. It's a wild scene. And this is 1968. Cars drove like shit. So I Google this, I watch this chase scene, and I'm looking at like builds that people have made where they've made replicas of that car, including this company called Revology that makes this sick Mustang. And they make like a new 1968 Mustang. Instead of it being a 1968 Mustang, it's like a 2023 1968 Mustang, but with modern technology in it. So this is Steve McQueen and this dude getting this wild chase scene in San Francisco. And it goes on for a while. This is when movies didn't have music playing when shit was happening. Look at this. It's just the sounds of the car, Steve McQueen's face. And now they'd be fucking this up with do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. But back then they knew how to make a fucking movie. But look at that car. Look at that car. That's a 1968 Mustang. That's a 68 Charger. So anyway, this starts showing up in my fucking Instagram feed. Now, that's really specific. How dope is that car? That's a dope car. That's a fucking dope car.
I saw it.
The scene's incredible. It goes on forever.
Do you think they cleared traffic for this?
For sure. They just clipped that car. You saw that.
Well, I know, but my point was there's a movie I've seen recently, same time period. I think it's a Jack Nicholson chase scene, if this makes sense, in maybe New York or Chicago. I read they didn't clear traffic. They just filmed it. I don't think it's as dangerous as this one probably, but they just filmed it and we're like, okay.
For something like this is high speeds. You can't have people walking their baby stroller across the street when Steve McQueen kills them.
Or you just pay an intern and say, hey, don't cross the street.
No,
right now.
That's not going to work. That car is 100% a part of the movie. So is that car. Watch how this car reacts. These are all stuntmen. These are all stuntmen.
Now
100%.
I would assume it would be now.
You see how slow that Volkswagen's going? That dude would not be going that slow. Look at this. Hubcap lost. Look at this shit.
All right, there's
this is a wild fucking movie, son. This goes on forever. This is what they used to do in movies. If you watch a lot of Steve McQueen's movies, Le Mans, same thing. Like the whole beginning of the movie, no one even talks forever.
I'm really good at falling asleep during movies.
You don't give a fuck about anything but training. I love it. I love it.
I'm like, anytime I lay down for too long, it's like it's a risk. So
right, you just pass out.
Yeah. I can't. Movies, I don't know. It has to be kids movies I usually watch.
You like kids movies?
I'm like, I'll do good with animation
Frozen?
Things.
Like Frozen?
Yeah, I'd be cool with watching that. I could probably stay up for that. But any real movies, I just don't have I don't have the attention span.
Well, it's also the drama that people go through in some real movies. Like, think about the actual real drama you go through for your profession.
Yeah, exactly.
Their things are so mundane, you know?
Yeah, no, I feel like I like to try to get away from that. I don't know. I am a huge fight fan, too, so I spend a lot of time watching fights.
Do you?
Yeah, every weekend. Last weekend, I was like, what do I do? There's no fights on. I just feel lost if I don't have a weekend of fights.
Do you watch only MMA, or do you watch other sports? Do you watch Muay Thai or anything else?
More MMA than anything else. I don't know. Even jiu-jitsu, I feel like I've never really gotten deep into watching. But
really?
Yeah, it's more just MMA specifically. But I think MMA as a sport is completely different than no-gi jiu-jitsu versus gi jiu-jitsu versus kickboxing versus wrestling. It's those are all even I feel like people look at MMA jiu-jitsu versus no-gi jiu-jitsu. They're like, oh, it's the same, when it's completely two different worlds.
Well, as soon as striking's involved, and also the gloves prevent a lot of stuff. It's very interesting, the difference. If I, obviously never fought MMA, but I've grappled with MMA gloves on, just trying to get chokes when someone's not punching you. You can't get things under chins. It's so much harder.
Well, it's just how you have to work for things, too. I think, when I go into jiu-jitsu competitions, I get stuck in a girl's clothes guard, and I'm like, how the fuck do I open a clothes guard? I punch you in the face. That's how I open your clothes guard.
Right.
I can't do that right now. So it's I haven't drilled that shit in years, where it's these girls are doing that every single day.
Yeah, the strategy of punching in the face can't be ignored. That's a good way to get out of someone's clothes guard. Yeah.
It's just easy.
A lot less effort.
Exactly. It opens up so many opportunities. Even submissions, it's I feel like for the Rose grappling match, it was short notice for both of us. I think the whole card was put together on 11 days total.
Oh, wow.
So I just had a short camp, but me just doing straight jiu-jitsu for that short camp, I was like, it's so much harder to get submissions when you can't punch them in the face, when you can't just get them to try to push you off or create the space, when you can't do the damage.
That's a really good argument for learning it the way you're learning it then from the beginning, because that's a really good argument for learning MMA jiu-jitsu.
it's a completely different sport. I think, like, I don't know. I think Nogi and MMA Jiu-Jitsu, they're just, like, getting farther and farther away from each other as the years go. I think that Nogi is taking its own path, and MMA is a completely different world, where it's, like, even my choking style, I feel like, doesn't translate as well to Nogi as it works for MMA.
Hmm. That's interesting. But it's like the level that exists now, both in jiu-jitsu and in MMA, is so different than at any other time. I'm looking at these guys that are just now entering into the UFC, and they look like world champions. Like, they move like world champions. It's such an interesting thing to see, and for you to be a part of it and to love it so much, it's got to be one of the wildest experiences a person could go through.
Oh, it's crazy. Like, at my gym right now, we have a kid who just started training with us. He's 11 and 1 and 20 years old. And I'm like, where did you get the time to get those fights?
That's amazing.
Like, my niece, she's 3 and just started training jiu-jitsu. I'm like, I can only imagine, like, people starting MMA at this age now, where it's like you've never really seen that before.
And if you keep going at the pace you're going, I think you could hit, like, really crazy levels. I really believe that. I really believe that you're one of the most exceptional contenders that are coming up right now. It's really exciting to see.
I think I built a really good foundation over the last couple of years. Like I said, I learned a lot. I got into the UFC extremely young, so I feel like it was a lot of stepping stones. But now I am in the prime of my life, and I have the right combination with Goat Shed and Dean Thomas, and I feel like I'm just in a good spot mentally and physically, and I feel like I'm ready for these opportunities that are coming my way.
That sounds like you prepared that one. Did you prepare that one?
No, I didn't.
Not at all?
No, not at all.
That's awesome. That's perfect. Print, cut, make a reel, put that shit on Instagram. Yeah, that's awesome. I'm excited. I'm excited for you. When you're watching some of these upcoming cards, what fights are interesting to you that are coming up right now?
The upcoming cards? Oh, on the Amanda Nunes card, the Beneil Darush and Charles Oliveira,
yeah.
That fight. I'm like, I've been waiting for that forever. It got canceled, now rescheduled.
That's
I'm like,
a good one.
That is going to be a matchup.
Beneil Darush's fight with Jakar Close was one of the craziest fucking fights I've ever seen in my life. It was so nuts. It was so back and forth. Beneil was almost out. Like, we thought he was hurt bad. And he finds a way to win. And his grappling is nasty.
He's got one of those types of grappling styles that's just ideal for MMA. Mm-hmm. He's really blended it in such a perfect way.
It's going to be interesting to see, because Oliveira is very, very good off his back.
And it's like, Darush technically doesn't need to take this fight. He could probably get a title opportunity, I'm assuming, before this, you know? It's like, I feel like he takes opportunity. Like, he's just a gangster, you know?
Yeah,
he's down to take it.
He is just a gangster. You know who I was thinking about earlier, I forgot to mention? Nasty off their back, Paul Craig.
Yeah, he's something different.
Something different. That dude's triangle is elite.
Okay,
holy shit.
Him and Jamal Hill,
mm-hmm.
I will never forget that. His arm just like flopping around there. There's nothing worse than that.
It was horrible. Luckily, Jamal's arm was fine. Believe it or not, it was just dislocated. I thought it was broken.
It looks so terrible.
I've seen a gang of arms get broken in my day. And that one was one of the most awkward ones. Misha, when Ronda broke Misha's arm.
Oh, yeah. That was a good one, too.
That was a good one. Yeah.
I'm like, it's so funny because in a fight, I don't have a problem like doing things like that. But then watching it, I'm like, oh, that's gross.
I think the scariest ones for me are the leg breaks. When Anderson broke his leg against Weidman, when Weidman broke his leg against Uriah Hall, like those are the scariest ones. Those freak me out.
For Weidman to be a part of both of those, I'm like,
crazy. What are the odds?
That's absolutely insane.
There was one that happened a few years back, Corey Hill, rest in peace. And then there was Anderson. And then after Anderson, who else? Chris Weidman, Connor, no one else? Is that it? I think that's it. That's it. And one of the worst ones is Tyrone Spong. You ever seen that one?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Oh. That was disgusting.
That's a hard one.
It's something different in kickboxing, too. I feel like the kicks are just thrown with more intention.
Oh, my God.
The way he stepped back on that is just something.
And that was essentially the end of his kickboxing career. I mean, he's boxing now. That's a dangerous man.
Oh, yeah.
He's a dangerous dude.
He's a big dude.
Yeah. That one fight where he got dropped early in the round and the dude's swarming on him, and he measures him, BAM! Woof! See if you can find that. Tyrone's bong, crazy first round knockout, because it's nuts. This dude comes after him, big tall dude, hits him with a big shot and drops him. And then the way he responds and the way he cracked that dude, just how staying calm under fire, looking for his shot, extending his left hand, then drops it right on him.
Just like a sniper. Like, some people, it's like, I don't know.
There it is.
Just the way some people's
Michael
minds.
Doot. Yeah, some people's minds are just.
I feel like they can just see shit that it's, I don't know, they see something different.
Look at that. Cool. Boom. Perfect 1-2. Drops him. I mean, on the chin. Perfect 1-2. He gets up. Okay. Stays calm. This dude's just swinging now. Now he's just wild and reckless. Measures. Bam. Woo. And that's the fight. This dude gets up and is like, what the fuck? Fuck this.
It took him a second.
He's like, this is not, I'm not good.
It's crazy the way people's bodies react to like being knocked out sometimes. It's like, I think it was Edson and
Shane Burgos.
Yeah, Shane Burgos. I'm like, it took him like 5 seconds before he really felt it.
Yeah, that was one of the weirdest ones I've ever seen ever. Just something happened, and he's backing up, and as he's backing up, he's losing consciousness.
It was like he was good, and then it just, he wasn't good anymore.
Shane Burgos is such a tough man.
Oh, yeah, he's a dog.
Oh, he's a dog. He's a dog, always. So here, he gets cracked with a good shot here, then he gets cracked with another good shot here, Edson with those horrific leg kicks. So I don't know where the... Is this it coming up soon? Yeah, it's just edited the whole thing. Oh, it's the whole, they put the whole fight in there? So obviously Edson is catching him with a lot of stuff. And as tough as Shane is, he's probably been hurt on multiple occasions in this, in these exchanges. Oh. Right there. That's it. So it was a 1-2. It was a 1-2 right there. Right there, 1-2. Boom, boom. And then it just, the lights go out. Crazy.
I've never seen something like that.
That was weird. Yeah. But there was a hard punch that, and multiple punches before that. Edson Barboza is a guy who doesn't get enough credit. That guy has the fastest switch kick I've ever seen in my life. His switch kick is bananas.
His last knee against Billy Quarantillo and then his knee against Benil Darouche, both of them were fucking
insane.
Vicious.
Insane. Yeah. I wonder how much of a struggle it is for him to get to 45.
I was on the last card with him, and it looked like it was a struggle.
He's so shredded.
He was, like, we were sitting there an hour before weigh-ins, and everybody was just sitting in their chairs, and he was laying on the floor in the back. Just looked like he was struggling. But the next day, he went out there and performed 100%, apparently. Like, he got that knockout, got that fight of the night bonus. So I'm like, I don't know how people do that.
I don't know how they do it either.
I don't get how you can make such a huge cut and just feel good on fight night.
Crazy. It's crazy because it's the amount of damage that does to your body. It's not zero. So, like, how much damage are you doing 24 hours before a cage fight just for that advantage?
And it's like, how much of a size advantage is it? Maybe 5-10 pounds? It's like, how much of an advantage does that give someone if they are technically better than you?
I think there is advantages. There has to be. Otherwise, people wouldn't keep doing it. I think that it's also, you also feel like if you get someone who does a lot of it and then they get a hold of you, you're like, oh my God, I'm too small for this weight class. You know, if you're one of those guys, like Frankie Edgar is an animal. Frankie Edgar weighed 155 and won the 155-pound world title. And he beat BJ Penn to do it. Frankie Edgar was beating everybody and they were way bigger than him. He just did it with skill and heart. And also he was so durable because he didn't cut weight. It's one of the things, like some of these guys that cut a lot of weight, there seems to be, it seems like the guys who cut the most weight have harder times after a while taking shots. It seems to have an effect. It's hard to tell whether it's just the overall cumulative effect of their career or if it's the weight cut. But there was a lot of questions about Pajeda. A lot of people brought that up, like whether or not the weight cut makes him more susceptible to getting knocked out. But we know it's not zero, right? It's not a zero effect. It has an effect. But it's also to be this bigger person and to be able to, especially in the early part of the fight, if you can get a hold of someone.
70 when he walked into the cage.
Oh, my God. That's crazy.
He says that, really.
That's crazy. That's 25 pounds. That's crazy. That's so much weight.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't understand.
Think about 25 pounds of water on this table.
Exactly.
He removed that from his body and then put it back in. What? Without an IV.
No, it's absolutely insane to see. And after that, being able to perform.
I think that's the thing, is that so many guys are doing it. When you see a guy who's as big as Edson at 145 or as big as Billy at one, I don't know what Billy cuts. But there's some guys in some weight classes that are just like, how is Marvin Vettori 185 pounds? That guy's giant. He's huge.
Oh, yeah.
But he gets down to 185.
All my fights besides my last one have been at 125 in the UFC, and then my last one was at 115. So just the difference between the 25ers and the 15ers is extremely different. I feel like that girl we watched earlier, Maria Agpova, I trained with her at ATT, and she would come at a camp around like 150, 155 and cut down to 125, jeez, where I was coming into camp at 130 and cutting down to 125. So, it's just, I don't know. I don't know how the girls do it, but I'm like, there is a huge difference between like the 15ers and the 25ers just size-wise.
Nobody does it crazier than Patty.
Yeah.
Patty's out of his fucking mind because he does it in front of everybody.
I feel like he tries to, though.
Oh, he does try to. Yeah. I think it's part of his persona now, but it's also fun. The dude gets fat in front of the world and then gets shredded again. He disappears and then gets shredded again. And then he gets fat again.
Yeah, even that I don't get. I'm like, by the amount I train, I don't get.
Look at so crazy. Look at the difference between the lower left-hand corner and the upper middle. When he's down to fight, he's a fucking character. That kid's a star. You know, if he gets matched correctly, and that's the thing. Like, if it was any other sport, you'd get matched. If it was boxing, you'd have a manager. That manager would go, okay, Patty, you got a lot of fans, but we got to set you up with the right opponents. We got to make sure that we test you in all these areas and build up all the holes in your game. And, you know, like boxers like to get to the title undefeated. They like to get to that title fight. 16-0, the challenger. That's what everybody loves in boxing.
I feel like it's getting more and more like that in MMA, too.
Mm.
I have more respect for fighters who is like, you can see that they've taken tough matchups versus the fighters who is like, they fought nobody, but they have an undefeated record.
What do you think about a fighter that gets an opportunity to take a fight they know they probably shouldn't take, and they take it early in their career against someone who's far more experienced and it can be very dangerous? But sometimes an opportunity presents itself and they say, hey, do you want to fight in the UFC? We got to fight against this guy, you know, top whatever contender. And people have done that before. First fight in the UFC, you're fighting a contender, which is really wild. But it happens all the time.
I've never taken opportunities like that big, like fighting contenders in the UFC. But I feel like it is important to take every opportunity that comes your way, because it's like, it's more eyes on you. You have an opportunity to show what your abilities are, too, even if you are like the B side of the matchup necessarily. But every opportunity I've taken, win or loss, I feel like it's helped lead me to the point that I'm at today. And it's also built the foundation that's like, you need losses, you need to learn, and you need that to fall back on.
Even if you know like you're seriously overmatched, take it anyway.
I don't know. For me, it's like I've never said no to a fight.
Wow.
I think that's a tough situation. I've definitely went into fights where I know I was seriously undermatched. Like when I fought on the Tough House, like I said, I was 3-2. I was 22 years old, and I fought Barb Honchak, who was 10-2, the Invicta champ. She was like pinned to win it, and that was my first fight in the house, and I ended up losing second round TKO, but it's still, I had my moments in the fight. I almost finished an armbar at one point, and it's like I still had that opportunity. Obviously got my face in front of Dana, got to be on the Tough House. Like, it was still an opportunity that opened doors for me in the long run.
You also escaped that straight arm lock when she had your arm extended.
Oh yeah.
And you got out. I was like super impressed that you got out of that. I was like, Jesus Christ. I hated the angle. When I was looking, I was like, Jesus! It was one of those, there was a moment where she was yanking on it, or I was like, yikes.
Literally, I thought during that moment, because everybody knew me as like the jiu-jitsu girl in the house. So I'm like, oh, I cannot let her sub me. Like, I'm not going to let her get this shit.
How close was it?
It was definitely hurting, but it's like, I feel like that little bit of frustration gave me that little bit of like push, that little drive.
That's funny. Well, you got out of it, but that was a very tough matchup for you. Yeah, that's the thing about, you know, the progression of MMA. You get these tough matchups, you learn, and it's fascinating for me as someone who gets to see fights over and over again, see fighters progress through their career. You get to see these people that have put these things together, and you see the learning growth and the curve, and you see like where they're at now.
And it's like ever since I was, even in my amateur fights, I had a lot of tough girls, but like all my pro fights, I've had two fights where the girls haven't made it to the UFC at this point. Wow. So it's like I fought all UFC level competition. My last amateur fight was actually against Cheyenne Blissmas on Rise of Warrior, my little hometown show. So it's like another UFC girl fighting when I was an amateur. So it's like I've always had the highest level of competition.
That's very fortunate. But Miami's a hot spot for MMA, right?
Florida in general, I feel like, is a hot spot. It's just, I don't get how people train in the cold, so I get why.
The only thing you have to worry about is hurricanes.
Exactly.
And alligators.
They're not that bad.
They're everywhere,
but they leave you alone.
Yeah, until they don't.
Until they don't.
Can't you just be comfortable to have monsters walking around your yard? That's crazy.
I remember when I went to the Tough House, it's like that's the first time I was really, I don't know, around a lot of girls from, they were all around the world. And they were asking me about alligators. They're like, what do you do about them? I'm like, what do you mean, what do we do about them? Like, they're just there. We just kind of ignore them. They're like, I feel like everybody expects them to be like chasing after you or something like that. They have this weird stigma around them.
Well, every now and again, they do get someone.
Every now and again, but like,
you're so comfortable with living around monsters that every now and again eat a people.
We have gators, sharks, snakes. Yeah. Like everything's trying to kill you in
Florida. But if you don't go in the water, you don't have to worry about the sharks. And, well, the snakes. You got a real problem in the Everglades.
Yeah.
That's nuts.
Yeah. And it's, the Everglades, those like 14 foot pythons. Like
they're fucking huge. They just find them. They just go. They don't even have to look that hard. They're like, oh, there's one.
I saw a video of one eating an alligator.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's crazy.
Yeah, we played it a bunch of times. There's a bunch of dead ones they found with alligators like poking out of the side of their body. Yeah, they've run out of things to eat.
It's just insane, though, like to be able to swallow something literally bigger than you.
Yeah. Literally bigger than you. Well, they've eaten everything. There is an estimation that 99% of all the deers, rabbits, raccoon, everything in the Everglades is gone.
Oh, wow.
99%. Yeah. All from the snakes.
Oh, that's crazy.
There's like nothing left. It's just monster soup.
It's just monsters.
It's just snakes and alligators. That's all that's left. And some poor fuck. Imagine if you're some dipshit who doesn't know what you're doing. You want to go hiking in there. There's a 500,000 pythons. A 500,000.
Oh, wow.
In Florida.
I'm like, you're opening my eyes to this.
Yeah.
There's
500,000 pythons estimated in Florida.
I've always seen things on the like news and stuff about that. Obviously, you see like the Florida man things, like catches a python. I'm like, I didn't know there's that many, though.
I think you guys are way too comfortable. You're way too comfortable. I don't think you realize what's like right. There's a wooded area that you go into. It's filled with monsters, and those monsters have eaten every mammal.
And it's like, I think like crocodiles, alligators are so cool. It's like they've eaten every animal, and they've been around for thousands of years.
So millions.
It's like millions of years. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like they survive everything and can kill anything.
They're cool as fuck. They are cool.
Yeah, I think alligators and crocodiles are really cool to me. I'm really fascinated by them.
Crocodiles are very different, though. Crocodiles are like a wolf, whereas alligators are more like a dog.
In Florida, though, like the crocodiles aren't as aggressive usually.
Well, are they as big?
We don't have a lot of crocodiles.
Is this a crocodile with a person inside of it?
It's a snake.
A python with a 5-foot alligator inside its stomach.
Oh, Jesus.
Eat it whole.
Whoa.
Oh my God.
Look at that. That's insane. That is fucking insane.
It's an 18 foot, maybe 20 foot python.
20 foot python with a giant ass alligator inside of it. And where was this? Where'd they find this one?
Florida.
This was in Florida?
That's where Everglades National Park.
Wait a minute. I thought the biggest python they ever found in Florida was like, I thought it was less than 20 feet.
Well, this is 18. This is roughly 18.
Oh, okay. a 5-foot alligator inside of it. You know what I'm saying that is? So it literally is monster soup. It's monster soup. There's nothing left. There's no raccoons. They're all fucked. Imagine being a raccoon trying to get laid. You're out there. Anybody? There's no one there. No one lives there anymore. There's no deer. Good luck finding a deer. They all got jacked by monsters.
It's all the monsters, all the people, too. There's too many buildings now, I feel like, Miami. I feel like there's no, I don't know, there's no wildlife.
Maybe you should encourage people to go hiking.
In
you
Miami?
Go to the Everglades. Yeah, yeah. Go to the Everglades. Go for a hike.
Solve both the problems.
That would be a real reality show. Here's a real reality show. Take some clout-seeking dipshit and let them camp out for the longest in the Everglades. Don't say, no, don't do this. Someone's going to take this idea and someone's going to die.
Hey, you got to put the disclaimer on it.
One of my favorite stories about Florida was this guy was involved in a car chase with the cops. And he parks on a bridge, jumps out of the car, lands on a gator, and gets killed in front of the cops.
Like that's one of those ones where I'm like, can we get that fact checked? How does that happen? Like,
just an asshole and karma come get you. Karma came and got him.
Land on an alligator.
It's like a movie. Sometimes scenes happen in real life that seem like a movie. Florida man runs from police directly into an alligator's mouth. When Brian Zuniga fled a traffic stop in Tampa yesterday, he had the right idea. Sprint away from the cops, jump a fence, hide behind a water treatment plant. But Zuniga wasn't counting on a justice-loving reptile. He's back in custody this morning with nasty scars on his face. Oh, this is a different one. Yeah, this is a different one. Many of these dipshits landed on alligators. Yeah, one guy died. This dude jumped off a bridge, though.
Got his arm bitten off.
Yeah, that's Gator Man. That guy wandered around for like days with one arm. He's like, man, I didn't know where everybody was.
Oh, this one just happened recently.
It's a wild-ass place. Who would have thought that Florida would be like the battleground for freedom in America? Like, who would have ever thought that Florida would be the place where all the people are like, we need freedom. Florida was the spot.
Yeah, especially I feel like during like COVID and stuff like that. It's like, I think that's what's drawn all the people to us. Mm-hmm. It was like since COVID, everybody, like you said, like with the freedom and everybody's just kind of rushed their way there.
It's so funny that DeSantis got so much criticism from that. But at the end of the day, he was right. And no one wants to admit it. He said, protect your elderly. Treat your elderly, everybody else, you should be able to go back to life. And he was right. And everybody's like, you're killing everyone. He was right.
Yeah, I think that we never really, gyms might have shut down for like a week, but we were still open, you know?
Thank God.
But like, there is nothing that really like shut down for a long time in Florida.
Jiu-jitsu gyms in LA got hit hard.
Oh, yeah. No,
they got hit hard.
I heard a lot about New York, how terrible it was.
Horrible.
Yeah.
Well, the Donahue Death Squad, they all went to Puerto Rico so they could train. Mm-hmm. Imagine that. You literally going to an island in the middle of the fucking ocean so you could train.
Yeah.
That's so crazy.
Yeah. It was, I worked with Dean a lot during that time. So it's like we would constantly just wherever we can find mat space. We don't even need mats. I'm like, Dean would drill on carpet with me if we got it. So I'm like, wherever it was, we made it work and we made it happen during that time. But it's like there was a lot of opportunities and there wasn't a lot of places closing either.
Well, the places in L.A., they, you know, people had to meet privately in different spots. They had to try to keep their game going. And then, you know, just hope someone wasn't sick. And everybody had so much anxiety. But I didn't hear of anybody really getting fucked up by it in the jiu-jitsu community.
No. And then it's like I fought in Abu Dhabi during that time. So it's like flying over there. It's like you have to COVID test, I think, 10 times before you touch the island. Like, yeah. It's just crazy all the things that you have to that we had to go through during that time period. It's like it feels like it was a different world then.
I know. And it's amazing that the UFC pulled it off. It was brilliant. Everybody was telling them, what are you doing? You're going to have fights on during a pandemic. You're going to kill people. You're risking people's lives. And they're like, look, we're going to do it with no crowd. We're going to test everybody. Not good enough. People still didn't want it. Don't stay home. As if somehow or another a respiratory virus is going to like dissipate because everybody stayed home. Like, stop. You're talking nonsense. It doesn't work that way. So they did it and it all took off. And then NBA started doing it with no audience. And then they started creeping audiences back in and like the Apex Center. And I remember the first time we did it in an audience again, it was, I think it was Jacksonville. It was crazy because, like, Florida was one of the only places where you could do it. And it was a full packed arena. And I was like, this is the super spreader event of all time. Because it was in the middle of everything. And everything was fine.
Yeah, I feel like the audiences have come back stronger since COVID, too. It's just, like, it used to be, like, first couple fights, there'd be nobody in the audience during the prelims. And now it's, like, the first two fights, there's already fans there. Everybody's just, like, ready to get in their seats.
I love that. When I get there and we're there for, like, 4 p.m. fights and it's already packed, though, that's exciting. But I get it. 6 hours is a lot of fights.
Oh, yeah. No, it's definitely a lot of fights. But it's as the fighter, it's, like, it's nice to have that crowd there. It's nice to have energy there. And, like, probably one of my me being Canadian, fighting in Edmonton was probably like one of my most memorable fights, just because of the energy in the crowd, just because of how many people were screaming. And it's like, I'm not walking out in Liverpool and getting booed, you know?
Right. Did that feel like it had added pressure on you?
It didn't add pressure. It just makes me I love it more than anything else. It's like the fights at the Apex almost like don't have the same feel to me. They don't have the same like vibe around them. Like, even like even the wins, I'm like, it's just like you're celebrating by yourself. To have the crowd there and just that energy in the room, it just makes everything different when you walk in the cage.
I totally get it. But as a fan, watching the Apex is really special. There's something about being able to watch fights with no crowd, and the fights are being broadcast on television. I mean, I was thinking at every one of them, like, wow, I'm so lucky that I can be here and do this. Because just to be in this moment, there's only 100 people here. And this is in the middle of these crazy, weird times, but I'm getting to experience Tony Ferguson versus Justin Gaethje. This wild, crazy fight with no audience. And it was a fucking war, a crazy fight with no audience.
It's so weird. It feels like it's almost like too chill of a scenario when you're in there. It's like, okay, I'm in a fist fight, but it's just like, because it's so quiet. It's just so relaxed. It's weird.
It is. It's very different to experience as a fan. I couldn't imagine the difference in, like, when you do something and there's no cheering. You know, maybe you hear your coaches and that's it. But you also can hear, like, specific instruction very clearly.
Oh, okay, and you can hear her coaches very specifically then, too. So it's like that definitely plays into it. And it's like, or I always like whenever just watching as a fan, like, you can hear the shit talk between the fighters, you know, on the mic. So, like, it just definitely adds a different aspect.
Well, that's why Mark Henry's got such a fascinating way of doing it, where he comes up with nicknames for every move, and they're different for every camp.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
So yeah. I feel like trying to remember that would be hard.
Rashad said he was blown away. He's like, this guy's – he writes out all these different names. Like, this would be the name of your friend. This would be the name of your daughter. This is the street you grew up on. Like, what?
Yeah, I'm not remembering all that. With Dean, I feel like he relies on my decision-making ability a lot. And he relies on the fact that we're prepared, that we spend 10 weeks, 12 weeks, whatever, preparing for this moment. So it's like I should be ready for every opportunity or every obstacle she throws at me. So you will hear him in the corner, but not often. I feel like he only talks when he feels necessary. So it's like there's like he trusts me to make my own decisions majority of the fight.
That's awesome.
I feel like also that's what's helped me build great decision making. And I feel like at a championship level, decision making is what makes one of the biggest differences.
That's a very good point. That's interesting. That's thinking about it like as for the overall health of the pupil. Yeah, because as you're going through the challenges, they're going to get more difficult and you're going to have to kind of sort it out on your own. And then whatever mistakes are made, you correct in the gym.
And it's like for me at the end of the day, it's like I'm walking in the cage by myself. You know, I need to be ready for that moment. I need to be ready to answer everything. And like, I think it was my second or third UFC fight. I had just one girl in my corner, and she was an amateur fighter, just because it's like I just needed someone to warm me up. It's like we have those 12 weeks of preparation, and I'm ready no matter what walking in there. So it doesn't really like matter like who's in the corner.
What does a camp look like for you? Is it laid out in advance, and does it include do you have strength and conditioning sessions that you do separate to your MMA training?
I actually don't do strength and conditioning at all.
You just do MMA training?
Yeah, I just do MMA.
Is that unusual?
I think it is. I think a lot of people think I'm weird because I don't do it. I think that it's more beneficial. Like, you only have so many hours in the day, and there's so many sports. There's jiu-jitsu, wrestling, striking. And it's like there's so much to learn. So it's like I can only invest so much time into each of them. So I choose to invest my time into technical abilities. And for my cardio more, I get it in rounds. So it's like I do jiu-jitsu rounds or strike or like MMA rounds. I do MMA rounds 3 times a week. So it's like I'm constantly getting that cardio work, getting that push. And I feel like there's nothing that can really match that MMA pace, that MMA cardio. So it's like you can do striking for 6 months, then come to jiu-jitsu and have shitty jiu-jitsu cardio. So it's like I think you have to be doing MMA to get MMA cardio. I don't think running or anything like that necessarily supplements it.
Do you guys do things like switch out opponents and live drills and things like that to like ramp up your heart rate and simulate moments inside fights?
Things like that, or like we said, say it depends on who my opponent is in the cage. Like if I'm going with the boys or with the girls. If I'm going with the boys, it's like they can push the pace for me no matter what. Just them, they're stronger, faster typically, and and we have a good group of 125 pound boys who can really push the pace for me technically. And then with the girls, we usually set like goals for me. So it'll be like, just try to score as many submissions as you can this round, or we're trying to score 5 takedowns a round. So just make sure you push the pace to make sure that I want to be ready to shoot 10 takedowns a round every fight that I go into, just so I'm confident in that. And it's not like a necessity of me, like, I need to get it to the ground this time. I can shoot 10 more times. We'll just come up with strikes. We'll figure out when the opportunity is right.
I like that strategy because you're essentially doing strength and conditioning through skill drills.
Exactly, yeah. All my strength and conditioning is just getting rounds in, doing sparring.
Well, I mean, there's nothing that makes you stronger than wrestling, right? And if you're doing that kind of thing, like trying to get as many takedowns as possible in 20, I mean, that is a form of strength and conditioning for sure. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. It's a different type of – we usually once a week we'll do big gloves, so boxing gloves and takedowns, and we just do King of the Hill. And there's 2 10-minute rounds, and those 2 10-minute rounds will kill you every time just trying to take someone down. And because we have big gloves on, we're hitting hard and then getting takedowns. And it's like those rounds, I don't feel like there's anything that pushes my cardio like that.
That's interesting. How much harder is it to take someone down with big gloves?
It definitely adds a different element, you know, and especially like I said, these rounds, we specifically like know we're going for the takedown. So it's hard, hard rounds.
Yeah. Is like when you're talking big, are you talking like 16, 18? How big are the gloves?
Yeah, like 14, 16.
Okay.
Yeah. Just boxing gloves. Yeah. Gloves. Versus using like MMA sparring gloves, like 6 ounce. Or...
What are your thoughts on hard sparring versus technical sparring?
I think you need a little bit of both. I think you definitely need to learn how to bring that dog out in the fight when you need to. So you need those hard sparring rounds. You need those rounds to make you confident in walking forward and confident in pushing the pace. But it's also technical sparring rounds is you need 100 times more of those. You can do as many of those as you want because you're not taking the damage. But that's what's going to build your reaction time, what's going to make you think more. A lot of times if you get too much hard sparring, then you get a little bit like punch shy. You're not going to build the right reactions. So if you get more technical sparring, you're building more right reactions and you're building I don't know. I feel like you need both.
Mm. I think you're probably right. And I think most people would probably agree with you. But for longevity, the one concern is like how much hard sparring you do in training and how much that takes out of your longevity, how much that takes out of your overall career. Like Max Holloway is not sparring at all anymore, which I found really fascinating. And his reasoning is he'd take unnecessary damage in sparring and I know how to fight and I'll just do drills and work on my conditioning and do it through drills. And he's been very successful doing it.
Yeah, someone like him, it might be a little bit of a different circumstance where he just has that dog in him. You know, you don't need any – he doesn't need the hard sparring to bring that out of him at all or to, like,
right.
like make him feel comfortable there. Like, that's just – Max has that in him.
He's also had so many high-level fights that, like, the timing and the – it's all in his head. He understands what happens. He's been there with Volkanovski, you know, over and over again. He's been in there with Conor McGregor in the early days. You know, he's a fucking animal. You know, Max Holloway's an animal. Oh, he's really good.
Max is, yeah, I feel like he's like the people's champ.
He's such a good guy, yeah. too. He's like the nicest guy ever. He's so friendly and fun, but man, when he turns it on inside the cage, holy shit, he's got extra gears. That guy's got extra gears. Like, he's another one that's a fantastic example of dedication and hard work and the results. Because, like, and he'll tell you, he's like, I'm not, like, the most athletic guy. It's not, there's nothing. It's just he worked harder than everybody. He's more intense than everybody. And then when you saw him in his prime, man, he was a monster. He just would put it on people and put a pace on people they just couldn't keep up with.
I feel like that's so much about what it is just showing up. It's just being there, willing to do the work, willing to be coachable. And it's like you have to show up. Like, I feel like so many people think it's just, I don't know, people fall in love with the stardom and the starlight of the sport, and they don't realize that it's just like it's the showing up every day and grinding and getting the work in that's really going to produce results.
Yeah, it is. It's a long process. It's a long, long, long process. But it's got to be exciting to be in the spot of the process that you're at, knowing how you were in the beginning when you just started taking kickboxing classes, to look at you now. I mean,
I feel like it's been a short process in the grand scheme of things. It's been 12 years since I started training, and 6 years of that has been in the UFC.
So, which is really fun.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So
that's crazy.
Yeah, like it's I feel like it's just gone by so fast, really. It's just it's crazy to work with people and, like, I don't know, work with people who it's, like, their first day and you're trying to teach them, like, all right, move your hip over here. And they can't, like...
Figure it out.
They just can't comprehend it. And you're like, was I ever like that?
Do you remember what you were like when you first started? Did it come to you easily? Did you...
It definitely came to me more easily. I don't remember, like, me ever being, like... I don't know.
Super, super awkward.
Yeah, super terrible. But I know I was, I know it definitely came easy and I was good at jiu-jitsu from the time that I started.
Did you do any sports before that?
I did nothing.
Nothing.
I did gymnastics when I was probably like 5 or 6 for a year. And my parents put me in soccer multiple times because they played soccer. My brother played soccer. My dad coached soccer. So it was like they tried a couple times and I quit a couple times. And then it was just they were like, you need to get some type of like hobby, some type of activity. And that's when I started volunteering with animals.
Oh. Did they, was it totally out of left field when you became a fighter for them?
Oh, yeah, completely out of left field.
Like, what the hell, girl?
Everybody expected me to be a vet. Like, that was just, like, the trajectory I was on. And I don't, like, literally my parents growing up would tell me, they're like, if somebody's, like, trying to start problems with you, just walk away, you know? Like, don't start any, like, fights or anything like that. They are, like, complete pacifists on that side. And I couldn't tell you the difference between, like, the WWE and the UFC when I started.
Really?
Like, I had no idea what Brazilian jiu-jitsu was, nothing. I had no idea. So it's like, it was just, I really don't know where I got the thought where I wanted to do it.
Was there a lot of high-level people that were around you at the time? Because you walked into Dean's gym.
I guess before that, like to walk into there, I don't really know what was my motive. But in the gym, he had a couple of, pro guys who were doing all right. Nobody too high level, but it was just, I don't know. I fell in love with the environment of it all. I just loved the grind of it all. I just remember when I was in the cardio kickboxing class with like a bunch of like soccer moms, pretty much. And after the first day, I didn't expect it to be that much of a workout for some reason. So I was like beat red in the face. And one of the moms, she was like, just make sure you keep coming back. And like, I just remember like always thinking about that because I don't know if it, like I probably would have kept coming back, but it definitely was like, I didn't want to on the first day. I was like, this shit's hard.
Do you think that lady saying that to you made you come back?
I think it might have like influenced something because I was like,
wow.
I was like, all right, now I have to. Like, she's expecting me to be there, you know?
Isn't that crazy? How just one weird moment, one weird interaction where someone could say something to you to change the course of your whole life.
Oh, yeah. I feel like it's so weird that it's, like, something, like, that I walked into Dean's gym.
Yeah. Like, what are the odds?
The chances that happened is, like, he's still my coach 12 years later. Like, that's just, like, I feel like you can't walk into a better spot, really.
You can't. You just got lucky. I mean, but is that what it is or is it destiny? I mean, it's a great story. If I wanted to tell a story about an MMA fighter who did nothing until she was 16, takes cardio kickboxing, and then some little old lady says, you keep coming back. And she's like, okay, I said hi to the old lady. Now I got to keep coming back. She's going to be mad at me.
I feel like everything, I don't know, everything in my career kind of did just like line up like that. It was like whenever Ronda got into the UFC, I was just getting into my amateur career. And then whenever I stopped being able to make 115, they opened up the 125 pound division. And it was like, so you had to have you had to have at least three fights and a winning record to get into the Tough House. And I was 2-2. And I was like searching for a fight, couldn't find anything. Then the week before the Tough House tryouts, I got a fight. And I fought the Saturday before, then tried out for the Tough House the next weekend.
Wow.
So I'm like, I feel like everything's just kind of lined up perfectly. Just, I don't know.
Do you ever wonder whether or not there's like a divine plan?
I definitely think that I was made for this. Like, I feel like I was made for this spot, made for this sport. And I feel like there is a reason that everything lined up.
What do you think that reason is?
I don't know yet, I guess. I don't know. I think I'm capable of something that a lot of people aren't capable of, and how I can, show this sport, how I can translate this sport.
You're definitely a unique person and a very thoughtful person, and a person that if someone talked to you and they did not know that you are a professional cage fighter of the highest level, they would never imagine it. You seem so like friendly and normal. And then if I show – like there should be a show where people get to meet you and then guess what you do. They don't guess what you do. They just talk to you. They can't ask you what you do. They just talk to you about life. They can't ask you questions about martial arts. They can't ask you questions about anything for an occupation. Just so, how do you feel about climate change? You know, like whatever. Just talk to you about shit. And go, what do you think she does? Zero people would say cage fighter. Zero.
I feel like it's almost like two completely different people, like Jillian and the Savage. I'm like, when I'm in the cage, I'm like, it's a completely, like, after, it's actually the Maria Agapova fight, I sit down on the floor and I throw up two middle fingers. And post fight, one of the UFC guys, he was like, so you threw up the two middle fingers. Like, what was all that about? I was like, I did that? Like, I completely like blacked out, didn't remember I did that at all.
Wow.
I'm like, it's a completely different person there. I don't take any accountability for that.
Do you have like a switch where that person comes in, or is that only when the fight starts?
I want to say it's whenever, like, my walkout song starts that I start. Because there's definitely, like, the pre-fight nerves. I feel like everybody has them. And I go through them all day in the locker room. And then as soon as, like, I'm making the walk, I don't have nerves anymore. Like, I'm just ready to go, ready to walk out there. And it's like, I don't know. Even in that fight, I was sitting there and I'm choking that girl. And I'm just looking at the ref like, oh, she's out, trying to tell him calmly. I'm like, it's just something, I don't know, something weird, something different that happens whenever that I'm in the cage.
Do you feel like you get like a tunnel vision? Do you feel like, or do you feel like legitimately like you're a different person?
It's probably more of just like a tunnel vision. After the fight, I think I'm a different person. Sometimes I'm like, I'm sitting there screaming and shit. I'm like, who the fuck is that? But yeah, it's really just a tunnel vision. I remember my last fight just looking around the other arena and seeing it just like a full arena, so many people. And then as soon as he's like, fight, are you ready? All the lights turn off in the arena. And it's like, it's just you and her then. And it's like, I don't know. It's just such a focused moment. It's such a surreal moment in there.
What is it like hearing the cheers?
I feel like you got to kind of block them out till after the fight. Because even as like during the fight, it's like, if somebody's cheering you on, it's like, all right, now I feel like I got to do something. Or you feel like they're cheering the other person on. You like,
do you guys hear boos? Like if it's in the clinch and someone boos?
Oh, yeah. Everybody's screaming the Ric Flair woo the whole time.
Yeah.
Like the second you get a takedown. I'm like, I'm sitting on top of this girl for 4 seconds and you guys are already screaming. Like, come on.
Yeah, it's interesting. But that's the problem with casuals. Like, they don't understand how hard it is to get there, what the consequences are. Maybe they don't even know you. You know, they don't get the consequences.
I feel like grappling also isn't like a casual favorite sport. They want to see you stand and bang. So it's like me being a submission artist, I feel like I haven't really gotten a lot of that attention, I guess, or they don't really, I don't have a lot of fans in that department.
Yeah, but if they watch that Meatball Molly finish, Jesus Christ. I mean, that is dramatic. When she comes to and she's kicking, you've seen it, obviously. When she wakes back up, and she, that is always weird to me. When someone comes back, it's like, where were you? Where'd you go? Where'd your brain go?
I've had it once in a grappling competition where I didn't go completely out, but like I tapped and the ref called it a couple seconds later, and like I couldn't sit up all the way and I just kind of fell back, but I was still there. But I just remember like I instantly felt like I was scared I peed myself at first. I was like, I felt like I was sitting in like a cold puddle. And I woke up and I was like, no, I'm good. I'm like, I just went out a little bit, but I'm good. But I don't know. It's such a weird scenario. It's a weird feeling.
Mm. I went out on a fighter jet once. I blacked out. We went 7.5 G's on this one thing, and it was with the Blue Angels, and you have to hold on to this. You're holding on to the whatever it is, the yoke. Is that what it is? What do they call those things? The fighter pilot will hold on to this thing, and they have to do this thing called hooking, where they go like this, hoot, 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 where you're literally pumping blood into your brain to try to stay consciousness, because the pressure of the G-force, you see black on both sides like an elevator door, like it's closing your consciousness. It's literally like a visual thing. Oh, yeah, it's Tito Ortiz went out.
Oh, my God.
How many G's did they hit him with?
Well, I'm not 100% sure. I just saw this going around and it looked nuts.
Yeah, they hit you with crazy G's and then you black out. And that's not good. That's not good.
That's not
also
good.
Like, what does that do to your neck when you're going all those G's and your fucking neck is flopping around? But I did it at one, but then the second we did another thing and I didn't hook quick enough, or I didn't realize it was as many G's it was. It was actually less G's than we had already done, and I blacked out. And then I woke up and I threw up. He was at 9 G's. Yeah, that's a lot. I did 7.5. I got to 7.5 G's. It's a crazy feeling. It's real weird. But you have to. I mean, you can only stay. I don't know how long you stay conscious for. Like, but those guys, they don't fly with suits. They don't have like a G suit. There's a certain G suit that helps you absorb. But either way, that's the only way I've been out. I went out. I got choked out by a plane.
I'm like, I've put more people out than I've been put out. So that's, I'm like, good. That's a good thing.
That's the perfect ratio.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's exactly what you want. I don't think it's that bad for you, but I don't think it's good for you either. Like, whenever I see radio DJs that want to get strangled, I'm like, I don't know if that's innocuous.
Yeah, I don't know the drive behind that, like why you would want that.
Steve-O did it on one of his specials. He had Tim Kennedy choke him out.
I watched it recently. I think Mike Bisping did it too with Steve-O.
Oh, God. Everybody's choking Steve-O.
Did it again.
Yeah, it was just last week. Yeah.
Did they both drop him? Because Tim Kennedy dropped him.
He laid him down quite gently.
Well, Tim Kennedy's a savage. He just let him drop. I think he asked to let him drop. I think we had this conversation, yeah. Didn't we, with Steve-O? These guys, so silly. You know, letting people choke you to sleep and then dropping you on your head. Okay. Steve-O's so nuts. He's so reckless.
That was my thought whenever there was the Nate Diaz altercation a couple months ago.
Oh,
with
yeah,
the choke.
We strangled that dude.
I was like, it's not about the choke. It's about him dropping him. I'm like, yeah. Him hitting his head on the concrete. That's what worries me.
Yeah, he did hit his head. He didn't hit his head bad, though. It wasn't like from a full knockout. Full knockouts are scary on concrete. Oh, my God, they're so scary. Because when people's heads bounce off the curb, people die like that all the time. It's like getting hit in the head by the world. That's what it's like. Your head cracks. It's fucking terrible. Don't fight, kids. Stay home. Go to the
exactly.
gym. Exactly. Go to the gym and fight like a woman. Right? Do you say that? Fight like a woman? Isn't that like a t-shirt line?
Probably. I'm not
probably.
Sure.
It should be, maybe. Are you, do you have any aspirations outside of MMA? Like, do at one point in time, do you think you'd like to do something else?
I would like to try to like maybe branch into like commentary or something like that. I really do. I just want to be in the fight game. I love fights. I love analyzing fights. So I would like to hopefully get better at that one day.
The UFC always uses fighters, which is great. I mean, it's the most insightful commentation you're ever going to get. That's not a word, right? Commentation? Commentary you're never going to get is from fighters.
Yeah, and Laura Sanko's killing it for the girls,
she's
too.
She's killing it. Yeah, she's doing great. It's, obviously, Invicta, you know, there's a lot of chicks that are doing commentary. And it's a great thing for the sport to have fighters like yourself that can – you have an insight into – especially if, like, there's, like, a big fight in your weight class, you know, like maybe someone who you could eventually face and you've been looking at tape on them and, you know, you could maybe exploit some things and talk about it. Yeah, it's I love it, like, when Felder does it or DC does it. Or I used to love Kenny Florian. It's Michael Bisping. It's awesome. Dominic Cruz. It's the best gig for those guys too, because you're going, you're still in it. You're still, like, going to all the fights. You're analyzing stuff. You're still a part of the excitement of it all, which is truly the most exciting thing. Like, I've been to a lot of stuff, been to a lot of sports, been to a lot of music shows, been to a lot of things. There's not much out there that's as exciting as a world title UFC fight. Not much. Not much.
Oh, yeah. I'd just love to, like, I'm not sure if coaching is necessarily the right step for me, and I would want to do something where I'm staying with a sport. I'm
like
staying
commentary.
Around it. Yeah, staying commentary, some type of thing where it's just, I need to be around this kind of energy. Like you said, there's nothing that can compare to a world title fight.
I think with someone as dedicated as yourself, too, you'd be very frustrated if you had students that weren't as dedicated. Am I right?
I feel like that's a common thing.
Yeah.
I think that it's hard to find somebody who is as dedicated as me a lot of times. Or people who, I don't know, I don't want to say wanted is bad, but it's like a
lot
of
people. That is
what it is. Yeah, people don't want to put in the time or the effort. And I'm like, this is literally your job or your dream. Why aren't you just trying everything you can to make it happen?
Yeah. It's funny. It's a discipline issue and it's a focus issue. And some people, they don't trust in the process either. They feel like they got better for a little while and then they hit a sort of a lull and they lose faith. It happens all the time. You'll see guys going through bad stretches at the gym and then you don't see them for a while. It's like, what happened? I don't know. I got tired of jiu-jitsu and like, okay. But you were like on a good path. You just got to be able to push through. You got to be able to get through bad spots.
That's I'm like, keep showing up is the biggest thing that I feel like is the
up.
You just got to keep on showing up, keep on being there, even on the day, especially on the days when you don't want to be there. You got to be there. And I don't know. There's nowhere else I would rather be. And I've been just showing up for 12 years. And I feel like it's worked out pretty well.
It's worked out awesome.
Yeah.
It's worked out awesome. And it's great advice. It really is. Because they're really, as long as you stay focused and try to be positive and try to be happy, there's a process going on with anything you're trying to get good at. And if you're really involved in something and you're really interested in it and you really focus on it, you're gonna get better.
Mm-hmm.
You're gonna look back and you're gonna go, wow, I'm glad I kept doing that thing. Imagine if I just quit.
I've always said I'm like if I work hard, doors keep on opening. It's always the like how it's worked. Me putting in the hours, me putting in the time, and doors have just naturally opened. So I'm like,
yeah.
I feel like that's just the key to it all.
I think you're right, and I'm glad this door opened, and I'm glad we got a chance to do this. It's a lot of fun.
Oh yeah, no, it was a pleasure.
My pleasure. And what are you slated for next? Do you have a fight planned?
June 24th against Tabitha Ritchie.
That's right. We just talked about that earlier.
So, yeah, three and a half weeks out now.
3.5 weeks out. Wow. That's a very exciting fight. June 24th. And that's the Apex?
No, it'll be in Jacksonville.
Oh, that's the Florida card. That's the Emmett Taporio card. That's right.
It's going to be my
first. Let me see that whole card.
It's going to be my first fight. First pro fight and first fight with the UFC with in Florida.
Oh, wow.
So that being my home state, pretty much, it's going to be awesome for me. I'm so excited.
This is a fucking great card. This is Gregory Rodriguez, Dennis Tululin, Brandon Allen, Bruno Silva, Neil Magny, Phil Rowe. That's a great fight. Ooh. And is this, go all the way up to the top. Is this is ESPN? Is it ESPN Plus or just ESPN? Because they've been doing them on ABC, too.
Yeah.
It's supposed to start at 2 p.m. in the afternoon. It's a little earlier, so it's probably,
interesting.
I bet it's on normal.
Well, we just did the ABC one. I wonder if they're going to do more ABC ones.
This doesn't say the TV.
Very interesting. Anyway. Okay, there it is.
It's on ABC.
Oh, it is on ABC.
Main card is ABC.
Main card ABC. Yeah. See, there it is. That's an interesting deal. Well, if I was a network, I'd want to get in on some of this action, you know? Like, they used to be so scared of MMA, but now MMA has really been normalized.
Oh, yeah. A lot of – I feel like I don't know. Now it's like you see things like bare knuckle MMA getting normalized more.
That's kind of crazy, right?
Yeah,
MMA
like
civilized
crazy.
Now.
Yeah, like I don't know. I've been to a couple. I went to a bare knuckle MMA and just a regular bare knuckle fight. And both of them, I'm like, I'm sitting there cringing the whole time. Mm. I'm like, I don't get that stuff.
It's a different level.
Oh, it's 100%. Just hearing a bare like fist hit somebody's face is a different sound, and it's something scary.
Well, the cuts, too. The cuts are crazy.
Your poor hands, too. I'm like, everybody's hands after every single fight, broken knuckles, broken, like, huge fists swollen just because.
Yeah.
Oh. I'm like, you can't not break your hand on somebody's head.
How, have you ever tried makiwara training? You ever tried that?
No.
That's what the karate guys used to do. They used to take, you know what a makiwara is?
No.
It's like a plank that has hard rope wrapped around it, and it's like bolted into the ground. And they would just practice reverse punches into this thing. It was like this hard thing that had like a little bit of give to it until they developed these massive calluses all over their hands. So that's like more of a mechanical makiwara. That one looks like it has, like it gives. Yeah, so that's what a traditional one looks like. And these guys would punch him. Look, Google like karate makiwara knuckles. See that? And they would just practice hitting their knuckles over and over again until they get preposterous looking. Just Google like for images, because some dudes have like fucking insane knuckles from hitting those things. That guy on the far left. The guy on the far left. Yeah, that one. That's what I'm talking about. Look at the size of his fucking knuckles.
Do you think that actually helps?
Yeah, like, for sure. Oh. It builds up calluses. Well, for sure. Definitely. Oh. My friend John used to do it.
I've seen it.
He used to practice with bricks. He was a Taekwondo champion, and he would practice with his knuckles with bricks. And he had one knuckle that was it was essentially like fused from calluses. It was this massive thing. The first two knuckles, like the index finger and the ring finger, were all just a calloused mass that he could smash people with.
And you see people like Muay Thai fighters do that a lot with their shins, like conditioning. But I've never seen that with their knuckles.
Yeah, that was what they used to do in karate. I think people still do it too. Although it probably is probably terrible for you. Arthritis and shit as you get older, but you gotta sacrifice. Listen, thank you very much for coming here. I really appreciate it. Give everybody out your social media so they can follow you.
My social media on Instagram and Twitter is savage_UFC.
Okay. Well, thank you. I really appreciate you being here, and good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye, everybody.